Got to get the tape rolling, sorry. Good morning. This is going to be the opening of our House, or excuse me, Senate Interim Judiciary Committee on November 19th.
And open the House Judiciary Committee is the joint meeting on November 19th.
So thank you very much for everyone being here this morning. Sorry for the little bit of delay on the start. What we have is a number of topics that we're going to be covering. All of these, from my understanding, are informational hearings with invited testimony. And to start off with, we're going to get somewhat of an overview on the medical malpractice. And I guess the first panel that we have is from the Oregon Medical Association. So Brian, if you want to come on up with your panel. And regarding the microphones, they're very sensitive. All we need to do is make sure they're pointed towards you. You don't need to be on top of it, or we'll actually get back feed. And the last thing I'm going to ask everyone that is in the room, if you do have a cell phone, we're asking that you turn them off because our intercom and mic system can be impacted by the transmittal through cyberspace. With that, thank you.
Thanks, Chairman Prozanski and Chair Barker, and thank you for the opportunity. I'd just like to quickly introduce the OMA President, Dr. Peter Bernardo, who's going to talk for just a little bit, and then our up counsel, Mike Crew, that's going to walk through some of the history of some of the past proposals that may be ripe once again.
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Peter Bernardo. I'm a general surgeon here in Salem and in practice, private practice now for 18 years. And I have the honor of being the Oregon Medical Association president this year. All things considered, not a bad time in healthcare to be president of an association, I suppose. This is not the first time I've been here to the legislature to talk about liability reform, and I suspect it probably won't be the last. I would like to really make 4 points today in my presentation, and then I'll turn the discussion over to Mike Crew to talk a little bit about what has been done in the past for medical liability reform. When you look at our current medical liability system, I think the first thing to really point out is that our current system is really dysfunctional. It's really broken. We have a system that spends 60% of the premium dollar on administration, on fees for attorneys on both sides of the aisle. 60% of the money does not go to the injured patient. That's incredible and incredibly inefficient. We have a system where 70% of the cases brought forward are closed without any payment. 70% are without merit, are frivolous, whatever phrase you want to use. But in any event, they come up, they cost money to process, perhaps $25,000 on average, and they are closed. 20% of those claims really do represent medical malpractice, and they don't go to trial. They're easy to pick out by anyone who's knowledgeable about the medical field, and they are closed and they are paid. And only about 10% of cases actually go on to trial, of which the defendant, the physician, wins about 80%. But the point there is that we have a system that generates a lot of activity for not much gain. We know for a fact that there are many injured patients with claims that perhaps are of low economic value who never get their day in court because they're not viewed as being potentially financially favorable by the attorneys. They don't come forward or they don't get represented. Again, from a patient standpoint, that's a shame. And from a system standpoint, that's a shame. So if I have any point that I can leave with you today is that our current system is really dysfunctional, is really broken, is really awful for everyone involved, not just for physicians, but for society as a whole and for injured patients. Our system, as bad as it is, certainly affects medical care for all of you, for our patients. Oregon, point number two, has a shortage of physicians. We have trouble attracting physicians to our great state. I grew up here. I'm an Oregonian. I came back to Oregon to practice after I did my training in Phoenix. I really didn't consider practicing anywhere else. But my friends are here, my family is here, and this is where I wanted to be. There aren't a lot of physicians who share those values in this country. As a state, we do not train enough physicians to supply our needs. And so we're in competition with every other state in the union to attract the limited pool of physicians. Here in Oregon, our physician population is aging, and we are really facing a potential problem here in the next 10, 20 years of are we going to have enough doctors to provide care in a state, in a nation that's looking at healthcare reform, that's looking at trying to provide health insurance and health care to all of its citizens. We don't have enough physicians in the state to provide consistent health care to all of our citizens. And the medical liability environment is a significant factor. We know that physicians coming out of their training look at a lot of issues, and the liability environment, the cost of their premiums, the threat to their professional career from lawsuit are issues that they consider. Texas, as an example of a state that put a cap back in place a few years ago, the number of physicians applying for licenses in that state tripled over the next several years. So it does have an effect. It has an effect on our state in particular. It's not just the access to physicians, it's access to physicians and the skills that they bring to our system. So today in this state, we have physicians who are not practicing to the limits of their training and skills. They have cut back on what they do and who they do it for. We have family practitioners who no longer deliver babies. We have orthopedic surgeons who are not doing back surgery. Here in Salem, we have general surgeons who have cut back on the highest, most risk cases, the most difficult cases, and that's easy to do. Portland, with its major medical centers, is just up the freeway at 40 minutes, and it's easy to send your patients there and not do that work here in Salem, and that's too bad. In the end result, we have patients who are traveling farther, or worse yet, having not being able to find a patient, a physician, no matter how far they travel. If trying to find a primary care doctor in this town is a real challenge. Again, the medical liability environment has changed the game over the last 10 years and has really affected care outside of the Portland area in particular. And finally, when you look at the medical liability environment, we've talked about physicians and trying to recruit them. We've talked about physicians no longer practicing up to the limits of their training. We also know that physicians change how they practice on a day-to-day basis based upon the medical liability environment and their fears of a lawsuit. And we can argue about the cost of defensive medicine to our system, but that cost is real and it's not trivial. And in a system where it's easier to order the additional test or easier to do the additional imaging study or the extra admission rather than being concerned that you might be sued for not doing it, you order that test, and that's an additional cost. So in summary, the medical liability environment is important to healthcare in this state. Our current system is awful. It really doesn't work well for the vast majority of injured patients. It certainly doesn't work for physicians, and I would argue that it's not working to the benefit of society as a whole. And we, as the physicians of the state, would love to see change, love to see improvement, really for the betterment of everybody. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Cooney & Crew. I've practiced now for 38 years. The majority of my practice, well, 35 years of my practice, has been involved with the OMA. And in that regard, we have, as a law firm, been involved in most legislative efforts by the OMA and others to address liability reform during that period of time. There have been a number of major bills, victories, whatever you want to call them, over that period of time, but unfortunately, we couldn't get any traction and or they, with participation, and I will explain that in a moment, or the bills themselves were declared unconstitutional when they went up to the Oregon Supreme Court, and I'm talking now about the cap. But the OMA has proposed many other amendments, if you will, to the current Oregon law as it relates to liability, which some have passed and many have had some traction with the legislature, but never got to the finish line in signed into law. And I'll mention a couple of those as well. I want to give you a bit of a historical perspective, and I don't want to take a lot of time on this, only because I know you probably already know all this, but for the record, I will. The first bill that I was involved with that actually made it into the law was in 1975, when Oregon passed the Physician's Medical Excess Liability Fund. And interestingly, in I think it was the 2003 session of the legislature, the OMA met with representatives of the trial bar, and we tried to model a similar fund, but we simply couldn't agree on what that should look like, and so it went nowhere. But historically, at one time, there was a law in the state of Oregon on the books that limited physicians' liability to $1 million. And any liability in excess of that, according to the 75 Act, had to go into this excess fund. Our problem was that as lawyers, we had some very real concerns as to whether or not that limit on liability would be constitutional. And there was an attempt to get a ruling by the court through an appeal to the Supreme Court. And essentially what the court did was it said, you're looking for an advisory opinion. There's not a real controversy between the litigants, the OMA, and then Insurance Commissioner Rawls. And therefore, we're not going to give you an opinion on the constitutionality of that fund. The net effect was that the fund died for lack of participation, because every physician in the state who would have participated willingly in the fund was afraid that if they put their money into the fund and bought the insurance policy with the lower limits that was called for, that it would be found to be unconstitutional, and they would be exposed to excess liability for which they had no insurance coverage. So the fund died and ultimately was repealed, I think, in 1987. The next major piece of legislation to come down the pike, if you will, was the 1987 cap on both economic and non-economic damages. I'm sure you're all aware of what happened to that, but in a nutshell, in a case, Lincoln v. Senko, the court ruled that the cap on non-economic damages was unconstitutional, as it denied the injured plaintiff a right to a jury trial, which was protected under Article 1, Section 17 of the Oregon Constitution. After the repeal of Lakin, or excuse me, after the ruling in Lakin, essentially in 2000 and 2003, there were attempts to get ballot measures in front of the public, and they were put in front of the public. One failed miserably, the other one almost passed, that would have enacted into the Oregon Constitution a cap on economic damages. There was never an attempt, nor an intent to cap, if I said economic, I meant non-economic. There was never an intent to cap economic damages, and that's very important. And a lot of people misunderstand what an economic cap is versus a non-economic cap, and I'm sure you understand that. But the point is that the cap on non-economic damages is declared unconstitutional. That issue was taken to the people twice, and it failed. And it's clear, given Lakin v. Senko and Smothers versus Gresham Transfer, that those case rulings out of the Supreme Court, that if there's ever going to be a cap in this state on non-economic damages, it's going to require a constitutional amendment. This legislature can't pass that into law and hope that it would be upheld. That, of course, brings up the Clark versus OHSU situation and the increase in the cap on tort claims, but against public bodies. But that's a whole different issue. I'd be glad to discuss that, because I frankly think that ultimately we're going to have the same problem with the law that was put into place by the legislature in the last session. When we have another case like Clark come along, there's still going to be a problem with the increased cap, albeit it may be smaller, but the point is, it's going to be tested. After 2000, and 2003, and especially in the 2003 session, the OMA put forth a number of proposals to address liability reform. We attempted to put a bill in, well, we did put a bill in on joint and several liability, trying to make liability in the state of Oregon absolutely several. In the past, the complaint, if you will, of the trial bar has been that we're trying to lay waste to the joint and several liability laws. And the truth is, liability in the state of Oregon, as we said here today, is several, except for the non-paying defendant, which then the plaintiff has the right to go back and ask for an adjustment of the payments from the defendants that paid. And the point is, it wasn't a big change in the law. It wasn't wholesale waste to that particular area of the law. Another area that we felt very strongly about and still feel strongly about is this issue of discovery of experts. Now, to be clear on this, every federal district in the United States allows discovery and deposition of experts. That's the federal rule. Virtually all state courts allow discovery of experts. Oregon is one of the few states that has what we call trial by ambush. You cannot discover who the other side's expert is. And I might add, I don't think that this, that what the OMA put forth in 2003 was supported any more so by the defense bar than what it was opposed by the plaintiff's bar. It was not a very popular proposition. And perhaps that's the reason why it's a good bill, because it really dove down the middle of the road and said, look, there's nothing necessarily wrong with a limited discovery of experts. And the trial bar's concern, and to some degree the defense bar was, well, you're going to open up this new cottage industry of depositions of experts. And that was specifically not allowed under that proposal. All that was attempted was an identification of the expert and a summary of their testimony, and both sides had to do it. Not just one, both. We still think that's a reasonable proposition. We have for many years tried to amend the law in Oregon on collateral source. And the law as it presently stands allow its discretionary with the court to offset certain collateral payments. And what we attempted to do was to make it mandatory so that it would stop double dipping. And it does occur. It is an unnecessary burden on the legal system, and I should say on the healthcare system, when double payments are being made. But that's the state of the law, and it's allowed. We were trying to change that. 2005, the OMA proposed a bill, House Bill 1029, to institute medical legal panels. And I won't go into great detail on the bill because, frankly, it was very long and complex. But what it came down to was this, that it did not deny the plaintiff the right to a jury trial. It did not limit the plaintiff's right to both economic and non-economic damages. Conceptually, what it did was it attempted to put in place a hearing panel that both the defense and the plaintiffs had to go to before they could get to the courthouse in an attempt to try to cut off this very thing that Dr. Bernardo was talking about, and that is these claims that really don't have merit. And frankly, there was some interest in it on the House side, but I don't think that bill ever received a hearing on the Senate side. I could be wrong on that. But in any event, and I know that Representative Olson was thinking about that bill back in the last session, I believe, but I don't think much came of that. So we still think the medical legal panels have a place in the law, and could potentially cut down the cost of litigation and put more money in the pockets of the injured patients. And I'll conclude by just saying this. Having been directly involved in this argument, I'm going to call it a debate, for 35 years, I've come to this conclusion, that is that we're never, as a plaintiff's bar, And on the side of the defense bar that I belong to, as well as representing the Oregon Medical Association, we're never going to find common ground on this issue of medical, of professional liability. Just doesn't seem to me that it's possible. And I really don't think that's what should drive the discussion, because this is broader than professional liability and or liability reform. I think it really comes down to the question of patient safety and how that can be impacted through a broader look at this and a more unbiased look at it, and also the cost of defensive medicine. And that, to me, is where the focus has to come, and not necessarily on just picking and choosing a few places to tweak the liability system. I think the issue is bigger than that. It's more complex than that. And I will be the first to admit that the cost of liability insurance is not a major driver of the cost of health care. I think the studies show that clearly. But it is one of the drivers in that, as Dr. Bernardo said, it does affect access. It does affect, the liability system affects physicians who may or may not want to come to this state. And access, we're going to see this. We were talking about this last night in a meeting. Access is going to be a huge issue as we go forward for the children that are brought onto the Oregon Health Plan, and it's going to be a major issue in 2011 when the baby boomers start reaching the age and they go on to Medicare, because physicians are not necessarily going to step up and agree to participate. And I think we're going to see a huge problem in Oregon relative to access. And if these kinds of issues aren't addressed, I don't think that liability reform necessarily is going to be all that important. I think it's a part of it. It's a part of the larger problem. And that's, I'll conclude my remarks.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to open up for a few questions. Realize that this is just an informational thing. I will put some stuff on the record, but I'm going to let questions be asked first. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bernardo, could you put some of the numbers that you started with kind of in context? These are issues we hear about all over the country, and I'm talking about the figures you cite, about 60% of the premium dollar going to administration, 70% of claims being found meritless. How do those compare to national figures?
Those are actually, our state data matches the national averages pretty well. And those are, in that regard, Oregon is not much different from a lot of other states across the board.
Any other questions? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bernardo, I wanted to follow up on Representative Garrett's question about you say in your testimony, in your written testimony, that 60% of the premium dollar goes to administration and legal fees, and I was wondering if you had a breakdown on which percent of it is administration, which percent of it is legal fees, and then also the 70% of all claims are filed without merit. Representative Garrett asked how that compared with other states, and I was wondering if you could provide us with some information about how that determination is made of what does without merit mean, and because that's a pretty staggering figure. So,
all right, so to answer to your first question, when you look at the administration versus attorney's fees, if 60% of that premium dollar is overall not going to the patient, not going to compensate someone for their injury, I would have to go back and look at my numbers. Of that amount, 40-45% plus goes to attorney fees. I mean, the underlying administration, the running of the liability system, has a relatively low overhead. Most of it is chewed up in costs from defense and plaintiff attorneys. So contingency fees and on the defense side, straight payments for hourly work.
So just a clarification follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So when you're talking about a premium dollar, you're talking about dollars that are paid out in an award, or you're talking about the dollars that are paid as a premium for the insurance?
Talking about dollars that go into the system. So the okay. Medical liability system is financed by the premiums that are paid by the physicians on an annual basis, coupled with their reserves and whatever they get from their investments. If you look at the money that's paid out on a regular basis, the majority of that money does not go to the injured patient, and that's the point to be made.
Thank you. And then the second part was about this.
In terms of declaring a case without merit or frivolous or whatever phrase you want to use, the fact is statistically, Again, the majority of cases that are filed are eventually closed without any payment to the plaintiff as compensation. So those claims are looked at by the liability carrier. There's discovery and discussion between the plaintiff's attorney and the liability carrier, and eventually those claims go away. They don't go to court, and there's no settlement. They are closed. And it's just a manifestation of the inefficiency of the system and perhaps the ability of the plaintiff's attorney to judge what is a case that has merit.
Thank you. And those are statewide figures in the 70%?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What might be the average premium cost for a doctor for a malpractice policy? I'm not talking about a specialist, especially like you said, a back surgeon, or I'm talking about a family rule doctor. What would that, is there a number you can give me, an approximation?
Sure. I think the average for a family practice doctor not delivering babies is around $18,000 a year.
And what would it be if you're delivering babies or going into the more of the specialty work?
Sure. So as a general surgeon at the time of the Latham decision, 1996-97, here in Salem as a general surgeon, I was paying $14,500 a year in premium. So that's 12 years ago now. My premium this year was $40,000. Now, to be fair, that premium's actually dropped or stabilized a little bit over the last couple of years. But in those years after Latham, that number tripled pretty quickly. If you're a primary care doctor or a family practice doctor and you want to deliver babies, then you're going to be paying a rate closer to what an OBGYN pays, depending upon your volume. So that's going to be in the $40,000 to $60,000 a year range.
I had heard that figure of $52,000 that I'd talked to some of my rural doctors. And Mr. Cruz said it wasn't driving costs. I can't believe that when 52,000, 52 weeks in a year, $1,000 a week, $200 a day, or $25 an hour on an eight-hour day, that's got to have some effect because the doctor has to have that come through the door to pay the premium.
Sure, I work most of Monday seeing patients in my office to pay my liability insurance. So the point is that if you total up the entire premium paid by physicians for their medical liability reform, or for their medical liability coverage, it ends up being a fraction of a percent of the total healthcare budget. And so that cost in and of itself is a part of my office overhead, the cost of my doing business. It's a rather disgusting number, quite frankly, when you look at how much work goes into paying it. But nonetheless, in terms of total healthcare cost to society, it's a small number.
We're staying on time. Representative Olson, but I want to kind of wrap this up. We've got another panel that we need to bring up, and then we've got to get
back
to
the task. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will be quick. Mike, have you been studying a little bit of the one bill that was passed by Congress or the House side on health care just recently that's 10 pages short of 2,000 that the Speaker sponsored back there?
I haven't. Okay. Chair Brzezinski, Representative Wilson, I have not.
Okay. Follow up. Just as real quick then. From my understanding of having talked with a number of folks back there, there is a section in there that actually, you know, let's face it. This whole issue that you're addressing right now has always kind of been a Democratic-Republican issue debate. But I find it extremely fascinating that the Speaker back there had introduced this bill that has a section in there that encourages some type of tort reform. And the one piece that in this section that they were really interested in wanting to try to do was to address the issue of screening panels. So that was actually my question, if you were familiar with that section that had been addressed in that.
Chair Brzezinski, Representative Goldson, I'm not familiar with the language of the bill. I'm familiar with conceptually that's a part of the discussion coming out of Washington, D.C.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and let this panel sit back and bring up our next panel, and there'll be some follow-up that I'll say at the end. Mr. Powers, I think you're up for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm not sure if anyone else was going to be joining you or not.
I'm flying solo.
All righty.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Good morning, and thank you, Chair Przanski and Chair Barker, members of both committees. I appreciate the opportunity and the invitation to come and speak to you today. My comments, I think, will be fairly brief, and I'd be happy to entertain questions that people have arising from those comments. Much as the previous panel did, I do want to mention some of the history of medical liability reform in the legislature, as well as outside the legislature, and how that's affected the intersection of medicine, insurance, and the civil justice system.
Mr. Chair, he hasn't announced his name yet.
I'm sorry. My name is Tom Powers.
Thank you.
And I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Thank you, Representative. But at the outset, I do want to mention that there are several things that the last panel mentioned that I think there is agreement on. And one of the important issues is that patient safety is a primary concern, whether for the defense bar, the plaintiff's bar, consumer groups, doctors, professional organizations, and for larger societies. So patient safety is an area of common ground. And obviously, the debate is about how we best get there. We also agree that many of the issues that were discussed in terms of the availability of healthcare services, physician availability, the affordability of care, access to care, those are issues that are much broader than are described by a debate or a conversation about the medical liability system, and we agree with that. We also do agree that the cost of the liability insurance are a tiny, tiny fraction of total health care cost and have a minimal impact on the cost of health care overall. The Congressional Budget Office describes that percentage as something south of 2%, perhaps south of 1%. So the costs are pretty low, and we agree with the previous panel to the extent that that's being recognized as more and more data becomes available. Finally, we do agree with the observation that rates in many places have largely stabilized and sometimes have gone down. That's an important point because it indicates that a lot of the insurance rate issues that are being discussed have less to do with changes to the civil justice system and tort reform than to larger issues of the insurance market, the premium market, the investment markets that insurers rely on to generate the income and the revenue to pay claims in addition to the premiums that they receive. So there is some common ground on some of these larger issues. Obviously, there are some big areas of dispute, and some of those were described. Some of them I'll touch on briefly, but I'm not going to go through and be redundant. There is a long history in Oregon of considering these issues, beginning back in the 1970s, and as Mr. Crew is describing in his personal experience, continuing through the 1990s and really up to the present day. The 1995 reforms did make changes to the tort system and to the civil justice system, made changes to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure in ways that affected any civil litigation, but in some particular ways affected the medical negligence claims that come through that larger system, including changes to joint and several liability, for example. It's important to remember, though, that throughout the Oregon civil justice system, there are very, very important safeguards in place right now that balance the interests of the parties and of the litigants and really make it a fair system for everybody involved. There have been changes, and some of them have been changes that our organization has participated in and has agreed to. Some of them have been contentious. But it's important to understand that the system right now actually does work very well in a lot of ways in managing the civil litigation system as it relates to medical negligence claims. And that is an area, frankly, that we have some significant disagreement with the last panel on. But I would like to describe for the committee some very important safeguards that are in place to make sure that the system is fair to everybody and that the interests of the both sides in any lawsuit are being taken into account, and why some of those protections and systematic changes really argue against the need to do anything different and to try to tinker with that, because it works in a lot of ways, and I'll be specific if I can. First, there's this issue that you heard the last panel describe about meritless claims and how does the system handle meritless claims, and that there must be some way early on to deem a claim without merit. But it's important to understand that when a claim is brought, a lot of times the facts at that point aren't known. And by the end of the process, a claim is settled, it goes to a jury, and there's a verdict up or there's a verdict down. But at every step of the way, the civil justice system and the Oregon rules, our statutes and our rules of civil procedure, work in a way to make sure that the merit of a claim is assessed multiple times as you go through. At the outset, Oregon's rules of civil procedure have unusually specific pleading requirements. It's what's called a fact pleading jurisdiction. In many states, you can simply file a lawsuit saying, I've been injured, this person injured me, and in a medical negligence claim, you'd say, this doctor injured me, and I'm entitled to compensation, provide very, very little detail. But Oregon rules are very fact specific. And at the outset, to even file a claim, you have to plead specific facts, describing what should have been done, specifically describing what did not get done, describing why that falls below the relevant standard of care, and you have to do that before you file the lawsuit. If you don't do that, Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure 21 gives the defendant a very early opportunity, within weeks, literally, of challenging the facts that you're basing your lawsuit on. So ORCP 21, combined with the pleading requirements, the fact-specific pleading requirements, eliminate the need for looking further down the road at panels that would be imposed to further assess the viability of a claim. There's also the discovery process. An entire section of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure are devoted to the court-mandated discovery, mandatory discovery from both parties to provide the facts and the information that the court ultimately would need and a jury would ultimately need to resolve a claim. And that discovery system works here in Oregon. There's also the opportunity through summary judgment with ORCP 47 to assess the viability of a claim, and after the discovery process, are there now facts sufficient to pose a question to the jury? And ORCP 47 requires, if a claim is challenged, that a plaintiff come forward and describe specific facts and talk about what the expert would say. So to the extent that there is legislation proposed suggesting that, well, maybe we ought to have additional requirements for expert disclosure in the discovery process, ORCP 47 and the current rules mean that you don't really need to have that. It's also important to recall that Oregon requires mandatory alternative dispute resolution. Before any case gets a trial date in a trial setting, you need to certify in your local court that you have pursued and exhausted mediation, settlement talks, arbitration, some form of alternative dispute resolution. So all of these steps in the system that have built in over the years make sure that the system, rather than being dysfunctional, is functional, again, from the perspective of both sides and the litigants. Some of these other ideas, in addition to being unnecessary under the rules, also impose transaction costs. Expert discovery, for example, having experts deposed before trial means that both parties, and this is probably, frankly, why both the defense bar and the plaintiff bar have resisted detailed expert discovery requirements ahead of trial. It imposes huge transaction costs on both sides. And to the extent that there's a complaint that the system, through the transaction of litigation, imposes costs that are passed on to consumers or to healthcare providers or to communities, we ought not to be imposing new transaction costs through ideas like that. So given the history of tort reform debate, medical negligence liability discussions in this state, we have in place rules and statutes that make sure that that system works. And ultimately, with patient safety, affordability of care, access to care, and physician availability as critical issues in the larger public policy debate, That's a discussion that happens, obviously, in a larger venue than here. But for the venue here, looking at medical negligence and the intersection of law and medicine, the current system works. The current system should keep working, and we ought not to be imposing additional transaction costs that simply aren't needed and that would not be addressing a problem that needs to be addressed through tinkering with the civil justice system. So those are the comments I have, and as I said earlier, I'm happy to entertain questions.
I assure you, you'll have a question or two.
I figured that I would.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, and thank you for your testimony. I would strenuously disagree that the system currently is working and is economic and is providing a patient safety and access. I represent most of 5 rural counties. The largest metropolitan area is the Medford-Ashland area. The smallest would be Lakeview, which is about 2,000 people. We have doctors who are leaving practice, doctors my age and younger that are leaving practice, either retiring early or moving out of, those of my age are generally retiring early. A lot of their younger cohorts are leaving the state because they can't afford to continue the practice. The cost of liability, as Representative Craker is pointing out, at $25 an hour in a rural area, that's substantial. You add 20% to the 20 to 30% cost of defensive medicine to this. You were simply limiting our practice. The physicians are limiting their practice by the cost of the medical liability menu. They look at how many of these cases do I do, and you know, maybe they stop doing appendectomies because they're only doing 3 and the cost of the medical liability menu. This system is ruining access to physicians in rural Oregon, period. So I would just strenuously disagree with that, your comments.
And the question?
The question would be, how would you address the rural area and how would you fix the situation in the rural area? Because what is currently coming down is not working, where our physicians are leaving.
Senator Wislett, Chair Barker, Chair Pozanski, physician availability and incentives for physicians to practice in certain geographic areas and within certain specialties, I do believe is one of those areas that, or subject areas, so to speak, that is very, very broad. It includes everything from how doctors are trained, where they're trained, and incentives beyond what has already been described even by the previous panel as medical liability costs that impose an overall tiny, tiny share of the healthcare costs in the system, suggesting that there are significantly bigger factors that are involved in a lot of those decisions.
With due respect, when we have physicians who are retiring in the prime of their practice life because they cannot afford the costs primarily related to medical liability insurance and the related things that go with it, I would have to disagree with that it's a very small, statistics, you're talking about the cost, the clear across the spectrum, but we're talking about in a rural practice, it's driving them out of business.
Senator Wissett, I'm sorry, I'm going to ask that if you're wanting, for all members, if you want to have the dialogue going back and forth, I'd ask that you ask sure. speakers to come in so we can stay on time. If you have other questions that you want to put on the record, I'm more than willing to have that put on the record so we can get a response, but we don't have time for this push and pull debate. All right, Chair Barker.
Thank you. With the discovery, the question about discovery of witnesses, would it be feasible to have just know who they are and not have a pre-trial deposition? I mean, in my experience in arbitrations, non-medical stuff, where we would need to know who the city was bringing in as the witness, and usually if you had the name with the internet and everything, we would know what the person testified to in the past, then they'd come and tell a totally different story, and you could then say, well, didn't you say in the past? Those kind of things. I mean, so just knowing who they are, would that be prohibitive, do you think, cost-wise?
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, thank you. The witness lists, including expert witness lists, are typically exchanged pre-trial, and the timing of that varies, sometimes within a few days, sometimes earlier than that by agreement between the parties. So the exchange of names often does happen. But the big concern, as I said, is creating an expert discovery system that really imposes these huge costs on both sides. Because what happens when you do that, and you get to the point of full-blown expert discovery, both sides really have to put on their trial almost three times with, as you know, written reports that are filed ahead of times, rounds of depositions, and then the experts coming back to testify. So anything that would tinker with expanding what is currently a work product privilege between the party on one side and any experts that have been retained, anything that would breach that privilege almost necessarily opens the door to this larger issue and imposing these huge transaction costs that really the system and the courts ought not to have to deal with, particularly given these other safeguards, specifically ORCP 47 and that disclosure requirement. That's the critical thing. When the underlying facts, specific facts, have to be disclosed at summary judgment, and basically summarizing the expert's testimony in an affidavit filed and served, that's a critical protection that I think makes other changes unnecessary.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Powers for being here and explaining that. I just want to get to a bigger picture. Do you think that we need more doctors in the state of Oregon to improve our access here?
To be honest with you, I don't know the answer to that question. My sense is that in certain parts of the state, probably additional doctors are needed. I just don't know what the overall distribution of physicians would be statewide to satisfy healthcare demands. But certainly, probably within certain regions and certain specialties, that's likely true.
Yeah, I would say that's true from what I hear. We need more medical professionals. We have people retiring. I think on a bigger picture here and looking at this issue, and I think the previous panel talked about Texas and some reform and having doctors apply for licenses, do you see the state of Oregon in a competitive environment for those limited amount of physicians that will be applying for licenses in the future?
Representative Cameron and Mr. Chairs, yes, there are incentives and multiple incentives that are either in place or could be in place to encourage physicians to come into the state, everything from the quality of the underlying education system, the types of patient care that's being demanded by healthcare consumers in the state, financial incentives. The Texas experience is an interesting one, and I would be happy to provide for the members additional information on this, but my understanding is that this significant increase in the number of licenses, that medical licenses that were applied for and granted in Texas recently, were really centered around one particular huge medical facility, and this was not a statewide phenomenon. And that, again, strongly suggests that there are other market dynamics, so to speak, that are going on to encourage physician participation in any state, but I'd be happy to provide that information.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I guess probably the last point is we talk about the cost of the total health care and how medical malpractice, what small percentage that is, but we heard a testimony earlier, it may be 20%, a one day a week for a doctor. And if the doctors are the ones that are driving the service to the people who need the access, and I've heard other testimonies. I mean, I've heard many doctors, one in particular that here in Salem that says, hey, I can do this procedure, but because of the risk of a lawsuit, because just the risk of somebody filing a lawsuit, knowing that I'm going to be sitting in a courtroom and I only do 12 of these and a guy in Portland does 300 of them a year, the standard of practice, I won't do that. So I send the patient to Portland. What's the cost of that? And how do we, when we look at the 1-2% of just the premiums and those kinds of things, but I think when you look at the cost to a doctor who's actually serving this, we have an issue here. So to make a statement that the current system is working, and yet the doctors that are involved in our system, some of them are here today saying it's not working for them, and I also heard the previous panel say there's no common ground here. I think we have a drastic problem. You're saying it's working. They're saying it's not. I need to hear something from you that says, hey, we do have some common ground. We have to fix this, and I'm not hearing that from you today.
And Representative Cameron and Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, fixing that problem is a larger issue than the medical liability and tort reform and making changes to the civil justice system. The insurance markets, the investment markets, rate-setting decisions, all of those macroeconomic issues and market issues that largely drive the premiums and the rates the doctors are paying, those are certainly issues that ought to be looked at. How the insurance system is managed and administered and the transaction costs, independent of anything to do with litigation in the civil justice system. Those forces have a huge impact on the premiums and the rates that doctors are paying. Again, that's a larger discussion. And in those discussions, there may be common ground. Members of our organization on behalf of our clients have sat down on some of these joint panels with OMA members, with individual physicians, Governor Kitzhaber's task force, Governor Kulongoski's Blue Ribbon panel. When there are opportunities to discuss those common issues of really insurance reform, not so much changes to the civil justice system, but insurance reform that would have a positive impact to address what are real problems with premiums and with the affordability and the ability of doctors to practice medicine and provide good care, those are areas where there probably is common grounds. We have always been and we always will be willing to sit down and participate in those discussions and get something positive done to fix the problems that are identified.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other last questions? Okay, I'm going to make a couple of comments. I scanned the committees here. I had the task, I think it was 2005, could have been 2003, where we had the last major task force and looked at this. I brought this issue to the committees today because I made a commitment during the last full session that we would take another look because I think there's been some dynamics that have changed. And so at this point, what I'm going to ask for both of the two panels that have been before us, I know that the OMA has already put together kind of the historical perspective and some of the things that you think could be worked on. If you're king or queen, I'd like to know what you think would be the premium things that you'd like to see done. I want the trial lawyers to do the same. I want that in writing so that can be submitted so everyone in these committees can actually have those. I will task myself, and then I will ask Chair Barker for some assistance of sitting down and talking to the individual groups individually and then trying to see whether or not we're going to go down this road during the interim period after the February session. What I'm not going to do is waste any of our time or your time if we're at loggerheads to the point that no one's willing to come to the table. But I'll tell you, if that doesn't happen, then you're kind of leaving us, the legislature, to go wild. And that's for your imagination. The last thing I'm going to ask is, Dr. Bernardo, if you could maybe just give us some explanation for those few patients that you mentioned that are, I'm calling the low risk, low claim, that aren't being actually, addressed through the process. What is it, or is there anything within the medical side of this that tries to make those individuals whole if you think that the attorneys aren't taking those cases? So, if you want to do that,
yeah. You want that answer now, or you want me?
It can be later. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot. So, I mean,
well, I would say only that the in our campaign for Measure 35 in 2004, there were several quotes of attorneys who discussed the limits on what sort of claim and injured patient that they would represent based upon the perceived value back to them, that how much injury was there and how much claim, how much money was to be made in that case. And there I don't know where the threshold is. That's not what I practice, but I can imagine that there must be some limit to the financial benefit to the attorney to representing a patient with a lower claim. Some money has to go from that claim to the injured patient, but the attorney has to make a living as well. And so there is a trade-off there in their representation.
I think I misunderstood, because I was wondering whether or not the insurers of doctors are actually taking care of those individuals that you believe are actually have been wronged, or they're just rejecting those claims out and then they're just out in the cold because
well, those system, those claims in general never come forward. So you know, in the typical system, a injured patient would not necessarily file a claim without an attorney representing them.
Okay.
And if they can't get representation, then the claim never comes up.
All right. So for the two committees, is there any other requests that you have the two panels to bring information forward? If not,
I've got a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be interested, because I heard some comments from the Medical Association on medical legal panels, and in light of what I don't know that Representative Olson brought forward, that if there's the federal legislation does address the issue of medical legal panels, I'd like to hear a comment from, not today, but later offline from trial lawyers in regards to that. Especially since we may be going towards a sole payer system, which maybe some of the lawyers won't be unemployed then.
All right, we're going to conclude this. I'll just leave it with this. Idaho is a model that has been used as an example for that type of panels, and so we may want some updates on that from both sides. With that, thank you all very much, and we're going to conclude this informational hearing on our current medical malpractice and medical access services. And next.
Sure. The next panel we have up today is on criminal justice, mental health system. Paul Evans. First panel, Paul Evans, Cameron Smith.
Current system works.
Mr. Wells, I didn't see.
Could I give some background?
Yeah, please, Mr. Taylor.
If I could, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Last August, Paul Evans contacted me because the Federal Veterans Administration contacted him over an issue of getting veterans treatment who were before the courts in Oregon, treatment in their programs up in Washington. It involved the Interstate Compact for Adult Offenders and its rules and regulations. We decided to have a meeting in Portland and expand on the issues. We had about 35, 40 people attend from throughout the criminal justice system and the mental health system and the veterans system. We had Representative Barker was there, so was Senator Schrader. And from that, we developed certain legislative ideas for session. We also worked on other issues that did not need legislation. You may remember the governor and Paul Evans was the head of this task force, had a veterans task force, and did a very lengthy report on veterans in the state. There were some very interesting facts in that report. We have approximately 14,000 homeless in the state, according to the report. 7,000 are veterans. Veterans make up about 10% of the population. Surprisingly, even though we do not have any military bases in the state, the number of veterans in the state is above the national average. Of those 7,000 homeless, most of them are post-Vietnam veterans. The Vietnam veterans were about 10%. Veterans are people who, to get in the military, do not have a criminal record or have very little of a criminal record. Something happens between when they go in and when they come out, and all of a sudden they start getting into activity that would normally get into, particularly with the war situation. We have the largest deployment since World War II. We have thousands of veterans coming home next year, and the legislation that that will go in through the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee will help deal and assist some of those people if they come into contact with the criminal justice system.
Chairs Przanski and Barker, thank you for the opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Paul Evans. I am a policy advisor to Governor Kulongoski for veterans and military issues. Start? Okay.
Please, yeah.
Yeah, all right. I thought maybe I'd interrupt the bill. I'm going to start off with just about a 4 or 5 minute overview and then hand it off to Jess and Cameron, who are really carrying the yeoman's load here, in fact, with Bill Taylor, your committee administrator, on these issues. But in terms of context, a couple of things I wanted to kind of remind the committee of. First, you know this, although sometimes the public forgets, we are still engaged in two military operations across the sea in Iraq and Afghanistan. We currently have about 2,500 Oregonians deployed in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. We have approximately 200 getting ready en route to go to Operation Enduring Freedom for Afghanistan. And we have an order out for next fall. We'll be sending about 900 overseas again. To date, we've had about 10,000 to 12,000 mobilizations, counting the Guard and Reserve, and we look to continue that number over the coming years. We are clearly focused on, in this state, the National Guard and Reserve elements because we don't have a lot of, as you know, active duty military installations. However, we want to make sure that everybody understands this is not just for the Guard or Reserve. Every month, we get about 500 contacts from veterans coming back to the state from active duty or from other types of experiences. So in terms of veterans issues, it's important to recognize what we're trying to do for reintegration of the National Guard. But there are 351,000 veterans in the state of Oregon. So, I mean, the size and scale is a little bit bigger sometimes than what we want to focus on. The task force, as you remember, last year came forward with a number of proposals. We were able to get 26 bills with your support passed. However, we did have 39 recommendations and told you that once we got the first wave done, we'd be back with some more. This is, today's conversation is in line with that next phase, that next chunk, trying to focus on trying to ensure that those that didn't necessarily have such a good reintegration, we find options for trying to give them a second chance and options to try to minimize the cost on society for the impacts that they're experiencing. For context, a couple of things to put in the back of your head. This is, to date, the longest war America has been in, at least officially. We have now a very, it's very average to see people not deployed once, twice, or three times, but now we're going into the round of, it's somewhat common to have folks being deployed four times. About 2% of the nation is carrying the weight of this war, which means that's a lot of pressure being put on a very small amount of people for a long period of time.
Yep.
So the bottom line is we look at these options, and whether these options are in fact put into law or not, we're either going to pay now or we're going to pay later. We learned with the experience of Vietnam that problems don't go away, they just get bigger. And we appreciate all your support and help on this. At that point, I'm going to hand it over to Cameron and to Jess.
Good morning, Chair Pozanski and Chair Barker, members of both committees. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, and I'm the policy advisor for public safety for the governor. I'm taking over for Joe O'Leary as he steps up into the general counsel position. And what I want to do today in my remarks is elaborate on the background and context for this discussion between the veteran support community and the criminal justice or public safety world. And I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge all of the previous work that has gone on. Paul has been a huge driver in this, and obviously the legislature has been tremendously supportive over the years. And the Department of Veterans and the National Guard, I am, and as full disclosure, I am a veteran myself, and I'm just blown away by the support that we have seen in Oregon, and it really is tremendous. What I will cover today, some of the context of veterans when they come back and are transitioning from war to civilian life, where the public safety world intersects with that transition, and then some of the tangible benefits that are coming out of this discussion and effort. And as I mentioned, I was an officer in the Marine Corps. As so much of this work on veterans issue that's been going on in the legislature, I served overseas three times, 2004, 2006, and again most recently in 2009. And like all veterans, I've gained an incredible amount of experience, leadership, values, discipline, and I'm thankful for that. But there is also a shouldering of that burden that what veterans bring back when they redeploy. And we recognize each time we come back to the states as a unit, we're taught to, and we know that the skills and habits that sometimes keep us alive on the streets of Iraq do not always translate well back into our communities. And a classic example for me is around something as an area as simple as driving. When you're in Iraq, whether you're running convoys between bases, whether you're going in the streets, when you come upon a traffic jam, it's not just a nuisance, but a potential danger zone. And it's going to be something, you might jump the curb, you might go into oncoming traffic, you might speed up. And that's something, obviously, that does not translate, that aggressive driving does not translate well back to the States. As much as I want to have a Humvee or an MRAP to cut across the blackberry bushes on I-5, or cheat cross-country across the fields to 99E when I'm stuck, that's not something, obviously, that translates well. And that's just one small example of significant mental health or other issues that we carry back as we redeploy. And as when you redeploy as a unit, there's tremendous support, there's close connections. I have no the reintegration efforts that the National Guard will fall in on from this most recent deployment is truly amazing, and it's cross-cutting across the community. But one of the challenges or gaps is that once you are out of your unit, whether you're coming back from active duty and then coming back after an honorable discharge back to Oregon, many of the invisible signs of war happen once you're outside of that kind of close cohesion of your unit. And when you come back as a unit, you're looking for those signs of stress in your soldiers or Marines. Are they quiet? Are they withdrawn? Are they anxious or depressed? Do they exhibit mood swings? Do they have change in their eating patterns? Are they abusing alcohol, speeding, driving erratically? Do they have financial issues or relationship problems? Those are the things that we look for as a unit, and we're better able in that structure to help get them into treatment or counseling and get them the support that they need. And that really is where the public safety or the criminal justice system can help play a role going forward. Part of it is identifying veterans early in the process in terms of the criminal justice system. We can see it can quickly scale up in certain circumstances and get pretty far along, but there's a lot of opportunity at the lower levels, whether it's a traffic incident, whether it's a minor dispute, whether it's the local police, the sheriffs, the DAs, the jails, the probation officers. There's a lot that we can do at the lower levels to help divert some of this away from our criminal justice system and keep the veterans out of that system. And some of it, what we'll hear today, can be legislative. There's some specifics that have been discussed, but a significant amount of it is just better coordination and better communication between these two worlds. We've seen the education community, just because of the huge influx of dollars from the new and improved GI Bill, there's tremendous links now between the education community and the veteran community. And we're further developing that coordination and communication between the public safety world, which is huge in and of itself, and the veterans community as well. And then very briefly, some of the benefits of this effort, we're keeping veterans in the asset column in terms of society, where they belong, and not as a liability and drain on limited resources. As Paul mentioned, we've seen what's happened, what we can pay now or we can pay later. I can't imagine what some of our brothers and sisters from the Vietnam era, how they were received home and whether those options, and compare it to today, it's a huge difference. And I think we're getting huge benefits out of that. We're obviously going to free up both short-term and long-term capacity in our criminal justice system. And lastly, I'll just say there's kind of a double whammy or a double benefit in that so many of the programs that veterans can tap into and that the criminal justice system can help direct these veterans into is paid with federal dollars. So we're leveraging those federal assets, and really we don't have a big base. We don't have huge defense industries in Oregon, but we are leveraging federal assets when we get folks their benefits and into these programs. And I'll be happy to take any questions now or at the end, and we can talk a little more specifically about legislation.
I was going to let the panel room and open them up. But
I had some questions specific to him, if I could do them.
Okay.
You talked about the multiple deployments, and Curry County has, I think, Paul, probably the highest percentage of vets in the state. It does have the highest percentage of seniors. It's the seventh highest seniors county in the United States. I've known a lot of these people, and some of them have really been harmed, and the Vietnam guys are still
carrying that. Yeah, I meet with them. They're still carrying that burden. So what I'm wondering is, you talked about multiple deployments, and then they have the issue where a guy's done, a gal's done. They're going to leave the service. Are we doing screenings and evaluations prior to their mustering out of their mental health needs and seeing that they're getting their services? Are we actually doing that today on all of them that come back?
Both chairs, Representative Krieger, Paul can answer this as well. There's a process in place, and that's grown since 2003 and 2004 and been scaled up to today. So not only on the mental health side, the physical side, what you'll see with that reintegration team that catches that National Guard unit, there's support for the families, there's financial planning, there's the health side, there's the mental health side. And on the active duty side, when you come back to your base, there's even a longer term than I would say for the National Guard, because you still are on the payroll. And that's kind of what the soft landing discussion. The longer you can keep them in their unit, the more you're going to have a benefit. Because when you first come back, you're more interested in seeing your family, getting out there. You haven't had a drink or had a beer in 6 to 13 months, and you have other things on your mind sometimes. Then how are you best going to get your support? So it's that kind of transition period. But the National Guard does huge outreach 3 months out, 6 months out beyond those deployments to continue to tap in.
Mr. Chairs, Representative Krieger, if I could follow up on what Cameron just mentioned, there's two pieces that I also want to emphasize that are somewhat new. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs, General Shinseki, has committed to ending homelessness among veterans in the next 5 years. Unlike a lot of secretaries, I actually think he means it, and his plan is focused on accessing mental health care for specifically the Vietnam era generations and a lot of folks that kind of got lost in the weeds before now.
Yeah.
The current program for current era veterans, there's a two-piece process. The first is they get screened on the way back, on the way out of active duty. The second piece is VA has been given additional funding to, as they try to access the benefit system, to get screened again. The ongoing negotiations between Department of Defense and VA in terms of a single medical file process for future veterans, which shouldn't be a big complex process, but it apparently is, should also ensure that what lessons are learned about an individual soldier, airman, sailor, marine, continues through the process. The one asterisk I'd like to emphasize on this, however, is in terms of future programming. We're going to try to take advantage in the state. We're going to try to take advantage of some of the homeless initiatives that the Secretary is putting forward. Not going to be asking for state resources, are going to be asking for official sanction to try to put some of these things together. Because what they're proposing is not just about veterans for this era. It really is to ensure that the folks that are in Curry County or in Coos County, the folks living in the woods, the folks living out near Bend, the 300 homeless vets that we know are there, that we reach in and try to save them as well. So again, I don't often trust federal government promises, but in this particular case, because Shinseki's a Vietnam vet himself, he's made this very personal, and he's trying to bring resources together to try to help.
Good.
Mr. Chair, I think I need to make a correction here. Just for the record, and so the committee members understand, the Oregon Army National Guard and the Oregon Air Guard are probably at about 250% of the average in terms of a reintegration program. We're 2.5 times better at this than any other state in the friggin' Union. What Paul did mention that I will take issue, and I just spent 30 days on active duty, so I'm quite familiar with this, and as all of you know, I had a son that just came back from Sandbox here recently, too. That 350 to 500 active component people that are coming back is really a hodgepodge. There are, just like hypothetically, one Marine division does it well, the other one is a paper check the block. I will tell you from my personal experience very recently within the last 60 days that the United States Army is dismal at it. If the guy is coming back and ETSing, that's leaving service when he comes back, he gets an out-processing packet and he goes to the deal, and I'd be happy to share those briefing slides because they're unclassified. Basically, you go to a PowerPoint slide and you go through about 10 PowerPoint slides, which is don't beat your wife, don't commit suicide, and a few other things like that. And you see Colonel Wisnet here chuckling, but it really hasn't changed. We're checking the block in that. And so while we have a great National Guard program that we're talking about here, in the criminal justice system, I would wager to tell you if the number is 350 to 500 a month, 350 of them are going to come back as problem children.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, the 300-500 are actually veterans of all eras just moving and sending their DD form for 214, so it's probably closer to 100, 150 that are actually current era veterans. I absolutely agree that different services, different units have different levels of focus on that, and I would also hypothesize, especially in the case of the Army and the Marines, mostly the Army, that because of recruitment issues, their focus on making reintegration look good versus trying to keep people in is somewhat mixed, because they are having trouble keeping numbers. So all I can tell you is that in Oregon, through the reintegration team, we try to reach out to folks when we find them, and that the Veterans Department, federal and state, has taken steps once they're contacted to try to get them into that assessment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. By trade, I'm a criminal defense attorney. For most of the last 20 years, I've been a member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. My remarks are going to be sort of an extension of the introductory information that Mr. Taylor provided. I was at the medical center, the VA medical center meeting that he discussed, and as a result of that meeting and then the summit that was, well, actually before even the summit that was held more recently, there's been this work group that's whose focus is to determine or try to identify ways or means or systems for diverting service members and veterans from the criminal justice system in appropriate cases. And you know, ideally, we would have multidisciplinary teams set up around the state for dealing with veterans when they land in the criminal justice system, maybe start with the county veteran service officers being involved or county sheriffs being involved, letting folks know, let the multidisciplinary team know that we have a veteran in the jail now, he could use your help, please come see what you can do for him, that sort of a thing. If we want to get to that, that's going to take time, that's going to take money, and it's also going to take some legislation and to facilitate that sort of thing from even happening in the first place. The work group that Mr. Taylor formed as a result of the meeting at the VA Medical Center is comprised of representatives from the Oregon War Veterans Association, Criminal Defense Lawyers, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Oregon District Attorneys Association, Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and Oregon Partners in Crisis. We decided to use as a foundation for the legislation we want to propose House Bill 3396 from the last legislative session. It was sponsored by then Representative Shields and several other members on behalf of myself and the Oregon War Veterans Association. I should also mention that I'm an associate legal counsel to the Oregon War Veterans Association. That's part of my private practice. But House Bill 3396 was originally intended as a two-part bill. One was, the first part was to enhance district attorney authority to divert veteran service member cases from criminal prosecution. The second part was to systematize judges' ability to mitigate sentences when the defendant is a service member or a veteran. In our discussions in our work group, we just concluded that we would just jettison the mitigation piece and focus exclusively on the diversion piece. So we want to have some provisions or enhance the provisions for district attorneys to be able to divert veterans and service members from the criminal justice system. And actually, we've reached agreement. I know that Mr. Taylor has sent a bill draft down to legislative council because we're just that far along. I mean, I really do think we're in unanimous agreement as to what we would like the legislature to consider. And the bill would basically run like this. There's been long-standing authority for district attorneys to divert cases. One of them that people tend to think of when you talk about diversion is DUI cases or drunk driving cases. The bill this we're talking about will not address drunk driving cases at all. We're going to be dealing, this bill deals only with the general diversion authority that district attorneys have had for a long time. But the diversion authority will apply essentially universally to veterans. I mean, as a starting point, it's just going to apply to veterans and service members generally, except that it will not, persons who are discharged from active duty dishonorably would not be eligible for this diversion program. The diversion statute provides a list of 10 considerations that district attorneys consider in deciding whether they should divert cases from criminal prosecution. The 10th provision is the one that is going to be the primary focus in a district attorney's decision on whether to divert a case. And by the way, I should say when a district attorney diverts a case, it's discretionary with the district attorney. There's no mandate of any sort of diversion. It's just something that the district attorney may do if he chooses so to do so in a proper case. The 10th consideration is mitigating circumstances, and you heard Cameron Smith discuss the sort of things that arise, that can result in mitigating circumstances. You might have a service member who's in the Guard or in the National Guard now. He's served two tours already in Operation Iraqi Freedom, let's say, and he's waiting, he's between tours, he's going to serve a third tour, and then he gets caught up in the criminal justice system. Maybe he has some issues that relate to something like post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury is also an issue that arises. There could be other issues as well, but those are the primary considerations, the primary factors that might give rise to a case where a district attorney might agree that this would be an appropriate case for diversion because of the mitigating circumstances that revolve around the person's health issues that are a direct result of their military service. Another consideration a district attorney takes into account is the impact of diversion upon the community. That's the 6th consideration. And that's actually one that I've been thinking about a great deal over the last couple of days because, you know, when we get that impact of the diversion upon the community and what is the community, if a district attorney is dealing with a service member that's in the Army, is in the reserves currently, or is in the Guard currently, and is awaiting deployment currently, not diverting the case could result in the fact that he will not deploy, and his unit therefore will be weakened, and his unit's ability to perform once it does deploy will be weakened, and there can be stresses put on that unit that could result in casualties that just might not otherwise occur if the district attorney were able to divert the case from criminal prosecution so that that service member could deploy with his unit. The next thing is that those considerations, the amendments to 3396 that we've agreed on would allow the district attorney to divert cases. Well, actually, I should say there is actually exclusions to what can be diverted. If a case involves serious physical injury, it can never be diverted. If a case is a Class A or B felony and involved physical injury, which is a less severe form of injury than serious physical injury. If it's a Class A or B felony involving physical injury, then the case could not be diverted. But Class C felonies that do not involve, or actually A, B felonies that involve no physical injury, those could be diverted. C felony cases could always be diverted unless they involve serious physical injury, and then misdemeanors could be diverted. Then the final point is that we agreed that the bill could be retroactive in one sense, and that is that if a veteran or service member's case is still pending in a pretrial status, so there's been no adjudication of guilt either by a jury verdict or by a guilty plea, let's say, that case could be diverted. But if the defendant service member or veteran has already pled guilty or he's already been found guilty by a jury, let's say, that's too late, the bill will not be retroactive to his case. And that concludes what I wanted to explain about the bill that we've agreed to. I did want to take if I can just sort of take a moment to answer a question that Representative Stiegler posed at House Veterans Affairs Committee, if I could, Mr. Chairman. This may come up again. Representative's question had to do with there are certain VA programs for which veterans are not eligible if they have pending criminal charges against them. And Representative Stiegler specifically referenced a case where a veteran would like to have gone into the domiciliary or the DOM, which is at White City, just outside Medford, but he had criminal charges apparently pending against him and was unable to enter. So the question is that, well, what if there was a diversion program available that were going to make these criminal charges go away? Would he then be able to go into the domiciliary? I wish I had an absolute answer, but my preliminary answer to the question is this, and that's that if those charges are still pending, then I'm afraid he's not going to be able to get in. That's my preliminary answer. But what I would suggest that what a good criminal defense attorney would do for that particular service member or that veteran is to explain to the district attorney that we have a gentleman here who could get into the domiciliary, the dom would be perfect for him, and we should make that part of a diversion program and make the diversion program move as quickly as it can so that he can get into the dom and not have to wait years and years before his eligibility finally comes around. That's my best answer for now, but I'll try to come up with a better one, or a definitive one, as soon as I'm able to. And that concludes my, and I, as I say, Mr. Chairman, happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay, questions? Mr. Taylor?
Chairman, as the committee, Bradbury is here from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, as is Elizabeth Kushwa, to testify in the record. And later, I would also like to ask Cameron Smith to address the issue of licenses.
We'll get to that. I just, one of my concerns about the present program is if they have a discharge that isn't dishonorable. In the days when I was in the service, it was virtually impossible to get a dishonorable discharge. They had all kinds of lesser ones. And there's people who, I know a young man who quit the service. He just didn't want to do it anymore and left. And they gave him a general discharge under honorable conditions. I wouldn't consider that kind of a person qualified. I don't want them in these programs. I want veterans in these programs who have been honorably discharged. And so we'll have some further discussion about that. But I'm concerned. I don't want people who don't perform, who have not really done their service, then, you know, wrapping themselves in a flag to get out of more trouble kind of people. And just one last comment. The way we're grinding the National Guard people and these other people, the few small amount of the country who's serving, and as we're going on America's war and everything changed September 11th, we're past due the time when we need to reinstitute the draft, and we need to have a war tax to pay for these wars. And with the draft and the politicians, when they, as they send these people over there, then can explain to the public why that's so necessary. And it's time we either do that, and just, that's a little editorial comment.
Do you have a bill on that, Representative?
We have a bill.
Do you have a bill?
We're overdue for that. Please.
And this panel and the one that just spoke, Jess, I'd like to have, we had a presentation to the Oregon State Bar for their continuing legal education. One of the questions that come up is to equal protection as to how we could potentially justify where an individual based on being a veteran would be able to get in certain programs where someone who's not a veteran. So if you haven't done that, we need some type of legal briefing before we go forward. Also, regarding the diversion agreement, the majority of them that are established under our statutes now are for a six-month period. Are we looking at having that, or are we looking for a longer length of time, if you can address that? And then in response to the question, at least from my work as a prosecutor, I know that a lot of the military branches will not touch anyone who has charges pending. And so I'm not sure if you actually put someone as an obligation in their diversion that they're going to be going into one of these facilities, if that's going to take care of the outside forces that we have no control over, meaning the branches of federal government, saying we're not touching someone while they have a criminal charge pending, even though it's being diverted. So if you all haven't looked at that, that's something if you can give us some explanation now, great, when your presentations, if not, that's something for follow-up.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just had a brief question before we continue. Can somebody please explain what happens during the diversion? Is it like a community service? What are the typical terms of a diversion?
Brad, go first.
For the record, I'm Bradbury, Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. Chairs Barker and Prozanski and members of the committee. I should probably start by thanking Mr. Taylor for putting this group together and for allowing us the opportunity to participate in there. And then Senator Bonamici, to get back to your question, it depends in part. DA diversions, as Senator Prozanski said, last for a period of 6 months. They are typically utilized by most DAs on first offenders to recognize one limited or no prior criminal involvement, and typically to address a particular situation. You may have a young offender who you want to get their attention, you don't need a criminal conviction on. We utilize diversions at times in my county. We have what we call a court coordinated services, which is a mental health court. We may utilize diversion to involve people into that. And folks who are on diversion, oftentimes the requirements of the diversion, almost like a contract, are probation-like. So they typically would not be reporting to a probation officer, but they may be required to do community service, perform other tasks as part of the diversion.
Thank you.
And just for the record, for those who are interested, in the state statutes, the diversion section is ORS 135.881. That will give you an overview of what we say as part of a diversion. But as Brad has said, each office has the flexibility of really massaging or putting together a specific program for that individual to meet the needs that we think are going to be for public safety and for getting that person's attention and compliance.
Good morning, Chairs. My name is Elizabeth Krishwa here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association by the purpose of answering the question about the pending criminal cases in whether they are going to be able to be admitted to veterans' facilities for treatment. Keep in mind we're dealing with two classes of people here. Veterans are different than active duty, so active duty people are under slightly different parameters than veterans are. And General Willis came to answer the same question in the hearing on Tuesday in front of the House Emergency Services and Veterans Committee and said that these people are indeed acceptable. The VA will take them, the treatment centers will take them for pending cases. The only time they don't take people essentially is if they're violent in that facility. And then they are not allowed to go through it. But other than that, General Willis came up, and I'm sorry he's not here today, but to say that these veterans are absolutely able to access these services. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Both chairs, members of the committee, one other point and one other idea that's kicking around is how do you actually identify within the criminal justice system that these folks are veterans? Sometimes that's acknowledged from the veteran themselves. With some of the older veterans, there's often concern of whether they're going to be losing some of their benefits within these court cases. So they're kind of not the perverse incentive not to identify as a veteran. So one idea that's been kicking around is can you have, similar to the organ donor on the back of the driver's license, could you have a V or a little V for veteran that the sheriff, the police, when they pull someone over, when they're first booked into the jail, they would flip it over, see that they're a veteran, and that would kind of trigger off some of the larger discussions and linking to the veteran support community. So we're going to be exploring that issue further with the DMV and seeing if that's a possibility going forward.
Okay. Representative Stigler.
In that regard, I would assume that there would be, that this would also cover active duty or guard or reserve members as well, and not just those who have served and are finished with their service and out of the service.
Correct. Both chairs, Vice Chair Stigler, I would agree. And it's the same, I mean, there's very specific within legislation what constitute a veteran. So that definition, I think, goes back to Chair Barker's point of who qualifies, but both on the active duty side, the reserve, the National Guard, as well as folks who have actually deployed overseas. And it's similar, it would be a process where you bring in your DD-214, the honorable discharge, just what I would bring in if I wanted the license plate that recognized my service now. It would be the same similar definition for who actually is able to have that little notation on the back. And we've made our license incredibly secure, and that's been a huge challenge with Real ID over time. So it could actually be something that could then be used within the vet support community to help determine who needs services.
Okay. Mr. Follow-up on that. Please. And this goes back to a discussion I had with Mr. Taylor after the Veterans Services about that whole definition of who this diversion and the same would be, I mean, who it would apply to. And I think I just double what the chair has said. You know, we want to serve the right people. We want to cover the right people, either active duty, guard, reservists, and those that have been discharged for other than dishonorable service. So I think we need to be really careful that, and I think there was some reference at the veterans hearing to serve that group in there. They don't have a dishonorable discharge, but they have discharge for medical or, I don't know all the different classifications, but there was sort of a rendering of various types of discharges that are not dishonorable, but they're not.
You got Representative Tomei.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm new to this discussion, so I'm just curious why that is desirable to have that on the driver's license.
Both chairs and Representative Tomei, I don't have a short haircut. I'm not wearing my uniform. I may still speak the lingo of the military, but I'm not necessarily recognized just by looking at any one of you. I don't know who has served. So it becomes a form of how do you, if folks, there is an opportunity when folks are first redeploying and first getting out to bring those papers to the DMV and self-identify as a veteran. The interest in the veterans part is kind of a, you know, I'm a card-carrying member. I get that kind of pride factor having that on the back of my ID. But then it actually becomes something that identifies me when I get pulled over, when I am booked later. It's an opportunity to actually be able to ID the veteran and then help get that person services.
Thank you. I just heard a testimony recently that every month 3,000 Americans are killed in car crashes, the same as happened in 9/11. So I'm hoping that the idea is not to be more lenient with veterans who are drivers who are getting a ticket or are in a car crash.
Both chairs and Representative Tomei, I mean, that's a huge concern, and it goes back to the equal opportunity remark. It's not about favoritism. It's not about getting more leniency. But looking holistically at our system and seeing how we can best get these individuals back on track. If you do a crime and it's significant, you need to do the time, and there's huge public safety concerns on that. But at the same time, looking at options and having where the DA, the defenders, the judge, the veteran support community, everyone's coming together to look at the best plan for this individual. And part of that may be, in certain circumstances, the diversion.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To clarify a couple of points that came up, and I saw Paul racing up here, so I might steal his thunder here. But just for the record, I am obviously a reserve officer in the United States Army, serving in the United States Army, not the United States Army Reserve. And in addition to that, I work with, I guess, 40% of the Marine Corps. I work with one of the MEFs on a daily basis. So I'm familiar with two of the branches of services, and I can answer a couple of questions. First thing is, anybody that's on active duty in the reserves has an ID card, which is routinely a police officer will find that when he's booked. However, the DD-214 is not there. And so anybody that's other than a retired reserve, Representative Wisnett probably can pull out his retiree card right now, but everybody else is not identified. The point here is to self-identify so that the police officer and the district attorney doesn't have to go down the food chain 3 days later and say, hey, this guy's a veteran. Why didn't we call the state and see what kind of state, what kind of federal services we can get this guy and make the federal pay on their dime to provide him psychological help, assistance, so on and so forth like that. And that's a self-volunteer thing. The second point that is probably different in this war, and I think Cameron can agree with this, is that for whatever reason in society, the political behavior of the previous wars, I could give you 10 television shows on either Vietnam or on the previous Korean War or there, in which behavior which was at least politically acceptable and tolerated during those conflicts is not tolerated in this conflict. The United States Marine Corps, I can speak for, I think unofficially, and the Army, I can speak for unofficially, you do something wrong, you're getting a dishonorable discharge. I mean, the level of prosecution, the level of responsibility today versus back then is totally different. You would not find the United States Army, and at least in the 40% of the Marine Corps I deal with, you would not find any of the behavior that Chair Barker said, anybody coming out with a general discharge. They're coming out with a dishonorable discharge, probably via the long course at Leavenworth, or at least in the brig at Camp Pendleton or someplace else. And so there's a lot more stringent in that. The other issue that came up that talked about is that service members that are in a diversion program, if you're already in the United States military as a reserve, Army Guard, Air Guard, anything like that, and you're in a diversion program, their deployment is based on what the civil authority allows them to do. You can't join, as Representative Barker said, but you're already in there. And so if the district attorney in concert with the justice system says, you know, Private Smith, who did this, you know, is in a diversion program and he can deploy, then he can deploy. And frankly, unfortunately, for whatever reason, a lot of reasons, the military, despite Fort Hood, the military is in a better position to deal with some of the issues that this soldier might have. You might be better off having him back in Iraq and Afghanistan than on the street dealing in our criminal justice system. And, you know, the system is not perfect, because I think all of you have figured out that the psychologist that was supposed to prevent everybody from doing strange things is the one who killed all the people at Fort Hood within the last couple of weeks. And the system's not perfect. One last comment, Mr. Chair, that I think is problematic, and I guess I'll go to history. When we were not doing well at Valley Forge, we got General Van Steuben to teach drill and ceremony. And Cameron would agree with this. You don't do drill and ceremony for parades, contrary to popular belief. You do it to get people to instantaneously respond. We are training, and I'm involved on a routine basis of training these people to go over there, for better or worse. And so the individuals that are coming back are trained to deal with civil society and police officers and other things in Iraq and Afghanistan, totally different than we do here. I don't think a single ground pounder, combat arms soldier, and that could be anybody in a huge that's working in the infantry in either of these countries, has a positive thing to say about the civil authorities of the police in these foreign countries. They are corrupt. They've all had corruption issues with them. And so you get this guy who suddenly is in a panic mode, just like he was on the streets of Fallujah, or just like he was in Kabul or Kandahar or anything like this. And their reaction is how they were trained, and their reaction is the police are corrupt, and right down the line so that. I won't bring up names, but I've had staff members in this building that to work for me that have exactly that, flashbacks. I have a very close person in my family that has been out for about 18 months, and due to an incident in the month of August, had a total flashback. He thought he was in Fallujah. So, and that was 18 months after coming back. So this is a serious problem, and like my good friend Jeff Barker, we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And unfortunately, the 41st Brigade is coming back as we're turning the light switch out. And I can attest to you, despite what the newspaper is saying, it is a whole hell of a lot worse in Afghanistan and Iraq than they're reporting.
Thank you. Anything
further? Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, one other thing that with the license will help. We heard from the people up the state of Washington. What they're doing in Washington, they're putting outreach workers in the jails to contact veterans and to get them into veterans facilities. And it showed, and the counties are actually paying for it, it showed a substantial savings in money. Part of the problem is that many of these veterans, they have mental health issues. They get into the criminal justice system and such things as criminal trespass. They repeat. They come in, they go out. And so it's an early identification when the license being part of it that will help possibly break that chain once they identify them. We spend $3.5 million to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs for county outreach workers, and that's one of the things that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is talking to these people about, is maybe coordinating with the jails to identify people at that stage too.
Both chairs, members of the committee, I would just add as well, it's great to have this discussion between these two worlds, and it often mimics I think to Representative Cameron and all his work on the reentry efforts of criminals, but all veterans are obviously not criminals. I kind of, we go into this discussion, there is an issue, but they're also fully functioning, and not just functioning, but adding to our society. So it's kind of tagging along on that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone yes.
Members of the committee, I know Alambert is not in your list of witnesses, and that's my mistake, but she's with the Oregon Partners in Crisis. She is setting up throughout the state conferences to develop multidisciplinary teams in the different counties. And then we have Madeline Olson here. One of the issues that was raised at our last meeting was coordination with the DHS, alcohol and drug treatment for veterans. Actually, the county mental health people raised that with Representative Collins, so she's here to address that issue.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Good Chair Barker and Chair Posansky and members of both committees. For the record, my name is Alon Lambert. I'm the Executive Director for Oregon Partners in Crisis and headquartered here in Salem. I also serve as a volunteer chair of the Veterans Mental Health Advocacy Council for the Portland VA Hospital, and I'm a member of the new Legislative Task Force on Women Veterans Healthcare. I'm a Vietnam-era veteran. And I'd like to thank you today for this opportunity to testify, and also I'd like to thank Mr. Taylor for actually asking me to come here. As you well know, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are the longest combat operations since Vietnam, and the multiple deployments are causing excessive stress on many of the veterans and their families, and so they're at increased risk for family conflict, violence, sexual assault, substance abuse, and many other consequences for veterans and their communities. And as Cameron said, it's not all veterans. My understanding currently is that approximately 40, it was 30%, now I've heard 40% of returning veterans will have a diagnosis of some kind of mental disorder. Mostly it's been PTSD and other things that go with that. And also the traumatic brain injury. And there's also the military sexual trauma, which has become a large issue also. And so the possibility for interaction with law enforcement increases with these stressors. We already, and other issues coming back, for an example, with unemployment, we already know that 35% of those returning in May are unemployed. So we have a number of issues to take place. I also feel that something that needs to be talked about when we talk about this is the idea of the unseen wounds of war, but the concept of, and I'm going to quote from Lee Berkman's book, Soldier's Heart, that the stress and trauma of war are unpredictable in the assault upon the human body, mind, and spirit. No one other than the combatants who directly experience the insane obscenities of warfare can comprehend the nature of the wounds. Every war fought still reverberates in the body, mind, and soul of the soldiers who face death and killed in battle to keep themselves and friends alive. I would want to address what we are doing as far as Partners in Crisis. Partners in Crisis is actually a nonprofit which brings together law enforcement, criminal justice, and mental health of how we all cross in within those systems and helping keeping people who have mental illness out of jail. And in this area, we are focusing right now on veterans. I wrote a grant that was funded, have the money in the bank that we are actually going to hold. It was going to be 6, and as of last night, it changed to 9 places in the state where we're bringing together all the stakeholders for the jail diversion, which all the players that were talked about, legislators, commissioners, the sheriffs, police, the district attorneys, the jail commanders, the veterans themselves, their family members, to bring together. We're talking about the idea of multidisciplinary teams, that if someone is arrested, a vet is arrested, that that team, which we're hoping to include the county veteran service officer, the law enforcement, the VA, the different pieces that need to be in that, and holding these within the different parts of Oregon, which is the Portland area, and you have a piece of paper in your packet, which I believe is the second sheet, that talks about the regional stakeholder meetings, and the down at the bottom I've listed the Portland metro area will be held at the Tiger Armory, Salem Armory, Eugene area will be the Springfield Armory, Roseburg, Medford, Bend, Pendleton, LeGrand, and Ontario are the places where we're doing this. And we are partnering with, yesterday I got permission from General Caldwell, and we are partnering with the Oregon National Guard Reintegration Team in doing these stakeholder meetings around the state. And part of what we're asking is to have all the interested parties come together to look at, to first to get an education about what are the issues for returning veterans, and not just the returning veterans, but the veterans themselves. We know that a lot of Vietnam veterans are being triggered because of these wars, and actually, my understanding from the VA is that there are now large numbers of Vietnam veterans who are seeking care. So what we do is the education, and then the second part would be breaking down into the different counties or local areas, because we know what's going to work in one area is not going to work in another. Each has its own issues, each has its own way of working. So breaking those down and seeing what are the barriers, whether they're federal, state, county, local, and then working on solutions to for that specific area of how to perhaps wrap these services around the veterans. So we'll be holding those, and I will have the dates probably at the end of this week. Yesterday when I met with the military department, we were looking at all these places, and then getting Sergeant Barry Vertner was getting the dates for us, hopefully yesterday or today. So should have them by the end of the week, but at least by the end of the month. We definitely will not hold them in February, and they will probably be in the more I-5 corridor area, probably in the second or third and fourth weeks of January. And then the others may have to jump into the early March to do those. What I'd like to tell you also is that as far as funding and something that was addressed, and Paul Evans talked about, is General Sinsecki's idea of 5 years having no homeless veterans. I believe that with that, we can apply for grants based on that sense of homelessness that is going to help in these areas. And also, there is a SAMHSA grant, which comes around every year, which is actually how I got involved with this whole issue, in that Addictions and Mental Health hired me in 2008 to respond to this grant. And to we realized that after the contracted with me is that we didn't have enough time to get everything done for the grant application. But to their credit, they looked at the idea of what is within the context of this grant, if we were to get the money, that we could do with little or no money right now. And part of that was to begin to look at who the stakeholders were and to begin to set up meetings. So I met with numerous different agencies, Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, got really involved with this and began to, went to the Florence Area Coordinating Council and places like that to talk about this. And what happened was that we began to put together the stakeholders, and then the last part of my contract was to actually write a grant and get it funded to hold these stakeholder meetings, which is what I did. In the meantime, during that year of getting stakeholders together, I met with retired Sheriff Raul Ramirez at the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Colonel Scott McRae from the Oregon National Guard Reintegration Team was part of that, and a number of other people came together, out of which then Jack Himes was asked to get involved at the VA. We began to hold law enforcement summits at the VA. The first one we had, there were approximately 22 people, including the National Police Department, via the video conference. And I kept saying during the year that if you could talk to you, I know that there are things that could be worked out with no money or little money. And so in those meetings, the ideas came, the issues came up about, for an example, diverting people into the Drug Court Administrators, diverting people into the VA Substance Abuse Treatment Program. And what we found out was that that was not available because the VA's program was not accredited, or as I say, blessed by DHS and ANH, I guess. And so I believe that that has been worked on, or was at least being worked on. And then at one of the subsequent meetings, Sheriff Todd Anderson, Tillamook County, had an issue with a veteran who was definitely danger to self and others, and they tried to get him into the VA hospital. There were a number of issues that took place that didn't happen, and so we began to look at what needs to take place, and that was when Bill Taylor and that whole group met, and out of that, many things have happened. So this has become a very large experience that actually started very small. So the SAMHSA grant, the federal grant for jail diversion with priority to veterans, is coming up again in, I believe it's announced in beginning of March and is due at the end of April. It is an award that is up to, and you have this in your packet also, is up to $394,000 per year for up to 5 years. as long as you meet those requirements. And so it has to be applied through addictions and mental health because it has come out the Office of the Governor, so that's the place that could do it. I believe from my talk with Richard Harris yesterday that he agreed that it was going to be applied for this year. And so that's where some of the money will come from. And then Bill Taylor had talked about the idea of what they're doing in Washington with the jail initiative for veterans, which you also have in your packet. The idea of the regional meetings in Bend, there was a meeting last Saturday. It seems like it's been longer than that. Last Saturday that I attended, it was called Veterans at Risk. And actually Bill Taylor told me about it. I went over there because I told them what we were doing with Partners in Crisis. And Representative Wisnett and Representative Stegler were there. And what we found by just having people talk to each other is that people who had not been doing stuff for veterans were willing to do things for veterans. So my feeling is that if we can do this around the state, that we can bring together all the people who are interested and need to be there, that we can actually, for little or no money, and what we're working with the idea is, we know there's no money, so what do we have now in place, or what kind of multidisciplinary team can we create together that will work? And part of the way I'm doing this is actually I'm creating a deck of cards that has all of the different players in it, and we will use those to as kind of a visual and kinesthetic way of looking at all the players that are involved now, how it works in each county now or region now, and then we'll take those cards and kind of throw them up in the air and say, okay, how can we do this differently? So that is what we're doing. So I would take any questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Ms. Olson?
Mr. Chairs and members of the committee, I'm Madeline Olson, the Deputy Assistant Director for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. I'm here today on behalf of Richard Harris, who had a previous engagement in Portland that he was speaking in front of a large group and couldn't change. I want to say just a few things, and then if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them. The issues of addictions and mental health among the population of people who have served our country in a variety of capacities at war are huge and critical. They underlie the issues of homelessness. You heard the statistics earlier. Over 70% of the people who are homeless have addictions problems and mental health problems. So we have, when those issues are untreated, what happens is that folks end up in the criminal justice system. They end up without the supports they need. They end up without the services they need to be safe. So that's critical. The state of Oregon is funded at this point to meet about 46% of the need for people with who have major mental illnesses. In the addictions arena, we're funded to serve about 25% of the needs for adults who have addiction disorders. One of the things we know is that folks, and particularly in the rural and frontier areas of our state, they're too far from the federally funded veteran services, and they have to rely on the community mental health programs. Those programs in those rural areas do everything they can to form the linkages they need to form to find the help for people within the limited resources that are available. And I think the work that Ilan and her group is doing really shows the power of bringing people together and having folks look carefully at the limited resources at this point in the economic circumstances Oregon's been able to make available and use those as wisely as possible to meet the needs of all of the members of the community, but particularly those who have served. When you hear from people that run the local jails or people that run the Department of Corrections prisons, they know that they don't do well for people that are incarcerated. It's not a good thing for the people who are incarcerated, and it makes it very, very difficult to manage the jails and the local jails and the prisons when these disorders are untreated in the criminal justice system. We have a lot of entrepreneurial, both counties and providers in Oregon, and they piece together bits and pieces of money to develop programs that will rescue veterans, if you will, from the streets and link them with those critical federal services. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions. Ilan, as Ilan mentioned, I think the year that we've had, a little bit more than a year actually, the foundational work that's been done will position Oregon much more strongly as we pursue the substance abuse and mental health services grant opportunity that's available. And so I think with that foundation, we have a higher probability for success if we get the grant application out this time. The other thing that Richard Harris has done is to name a veterans contact in the in our division. It will be Leah Kraft, and she's done a lot of work in earlier jobs she had with the Department of Human Services and is establishing strong working relationships with the Oregon Veterans Division or department. The other thing that we're doing is going through, and whenever the series of meetings that Bill Taylor brought together this fall, we've discovered things inside of the bureaucratic system that we can overcome that don't require changing laws. It just requires looking more carefully at the rules and regulations we have and making the system work on behalf of people, getting programs licensed that needed to be licensed, and looking out and solving these problems. And we're committed to continue to do that.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Colonel Wisniewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just like to comment that the state of Deschutes County, we organized our meeting to look into this issue. It's called Vets in Crisis, and Mrs. Lambert was good enough to come over and brief us on that. The state of Deschutes County was looking at Veterans Court, and just for the committee's information, I think that Representative Steeler and I have talked about it too, and I don't think the money's there or the effort's going to be there, but we could definitely make it part of the mental health court system that we want to be sure that that's doing that. And for Representative Tomei's information, I think that part of this solution will be that we're using some VA federal money to treat these veterans. It will help the overall funding or availability for mental health dollars for other treatment of other people too. So there's some pluses for that. So again, appreciate all the work that everyone's done on this effort. It's definitely justified. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairs, may I make another comment? The structure that we're setting up for these around the veterans is going to be the structure that Partners in Crisis would like to keep going to talk about the issues with criminal justice and mental health outside of the veterans also. And the second point is that there is a veterans mobile van, which I believe was gotten in February, and it has been sitting. And it was in Salem. Now I believe it's, or it was in Eugene. I believe it's in Salem. And as we talked about in the meeting at in Bend, that is supposed to be serving people in the rural areas. And my opinion is that that van needs to be in Bend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gary Guidos, Jess Barton, and Charles Williamson.
Morning, Jerry. Chair Prozanski and Chair Barker, thank you for allowing us to be here. I'm Jerry Guidos, current president of the Oregon State Bar, and I appreciate the opportunity. I'm actually thankful that I've been here for quite a while listening today, and I appreciate your taking the time to really look at these issues. I happen to be a Vietnam-era vet. I was a JAG officer, and it actually makes me proud of this state and of you as legislators to be dealing with these issues, so thank you. I've also been asked to be short, and I'm a quick learner, so I will be short. I'm here on behalf of the 14,000 members of the State Bar. We have a military assistance panel that Charlie Williamson will talk about. We also have pro bono aspirational standards of 80 hours. Last year, about 1,989 members of the bar gave over 163,000 hours of pro bono service. We know that's understated because a lot of us don't report those pro bono hours. I'm particularly proud of the bar's role in bringing forth the legislation last session that Charlie will talk about. that provide service member state remedies if companies ignore their obligations under the Federal Service Member Civil Relief Act. It used to be Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act when I was able to talk about it. So earlier this month, the Board of Governors passed a resolution on the occasion of Veterans Day extending gratitude to those who are serving, and we view the Military Assistance Panel as a way to translate that sentiment into action. And Charlie Williamson, thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. I won't read this testimony, and I've also given you written testimony from Jesse Barton, so we'll try and keep the time to get you back on schedule here. The Oregon State Bar did establish a military assistance panel of attorneys. We recruited, actually, I think back in 2003 when I was president of the bar, we recruited about 150 attorneys. I think we have about 125 now. The military refers us folks that need help. And we have a lawyer referral service anyway, so we were able to sort of patch this onto it. And over the years, we've handled about 450 cases. Theoretically, folks are signed up to donate 2 hours, but I think everybody that gets a bona fide case handles it for free from beginning to end, and that's certainly what I've done. The types of cases that veterans are faced with on our panel are primarily family law, and it's getting worse in this area because of the multiple deployments. Second is consumer law, where credit card companies or other collection agencies don't respect the Service Member Civil Relief Act rights that a soldier has. These cases are beginning to fall off, I think, and I think one of the reasons, and this is what Jess was going to talk about, is the law that you folks passed last time, House Bill 2303, that gives the service member the right to attorney fees and damages, substantial damages, if a merchant or a creditor doesn't respect the service member's rights. And that's really, it's funny, in the bar we had a big debate about what to put in the bill, and the debtor-creditor section was very active in that, and I think a lot of those folks went back and told their clients, you better watch out with this new bill. Jess collected some data from folks trying to find out how many folks have used this act, and he found one fellow JAG officer who was in Iraq, who said he'd used it 54 times. Nobody has ever collected attorney fees yet, as we under the bill, but you just bring it up and the creditors fall right into line. They say, oh, okay, we see. So the bill has had a great effect. It hasn't made any attorneys any money, but it's really helped veterans. I won't read you all the testimony we've got here, but we'd gladly answer any questions that you have on this subject.
Well, thank you very much. We're not trying to rush you. I saw a lot of movement in the back room. I had asked staff just to know how much time we needed for the rest of the presentation. So if there's more that you want to give to us, I mean, this is having Jess's written testimony will help us. Questions from anyone?
Thanks for doing what they're doing.
Yeah. And I think this is a time, just as Representative just said, you know, for the state bar to take the lead with the attorneys in the state to get them involved in doing work throughout the state, and especially and specifically now looking at the issues that with many people who have served in the military or are actively in the military, where they do need that assistance because we're calling on them to do a service, and unfortunately they can't take care of things at home while they're deployed. So thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick comment to see where we are today. Under the Reemployment Act, I mean, in the early portions, at least up until beginning of the last session, 90% of the people losing their jobs coming back were actually losing them from public sector entities who threw them out in the street from their previous jobs versus private sector, which is about 90-10. Can you give me a grasp today of where we are? Is it still 90% of the people losing their jobs, or it's public entities like cities, counties? I'm not beating on cities, counties, and state, but various public entities like that versus private sector. Private sector was doing a pretty good job up until recently.
I don't think we've had a lot of referrals for that. I think the JAG officers are writing about that, and there are, when we first started this panel, there were only one or two JAG officers to help service members. Now there's five. Rudy Murgo, Lieutenant Colonel Murgo, is volunteering. He's a retired judge. And I think that there's been some court judgments, I think, against folks for not respecting that law. So I think it's, you know, the knowledge of it is creeping out into the public and into the public agencies.
Right, thanks.
All right. Any other comments or questions?
Just a quick question, Mr. Yes. Chair. Thank you. I have a question about outreach and how people find out about the military assistance panel.
Well, we did a little TV show that got shown, you know, hundreds of times on cable, so to get it out there. Most of the referrals that we get come from the military. The service member goes to the military and asks what they do, and they refer them to us. That's the primary way we get them. I imagine that we get some through the referral service when they call asking for help. And in their conversation, it probably gets referred to an attorney or perhaps to the military and then back to us.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here today and for your testimony.
Thank you.
So, colleagues, we had scheduled an update on Muchaca decision. This is a case that came out of the Court of Appeals dealing with driving under the influence of intoxicants and the implied consent. The reality at this point, we've decided to take it off the agenda today and have it reserved for next time. The reason for that is the Supreme Court has, in fact, accepted the case for review. They have gone with an accelerated rate of requirement for briefs to be filed. My understanding that oral arguments are set for December 16th. And so we expect that they're expediting this, and we more than likely will have a decision before we come in February. So instead of, let's say, talking about something that may be in the abstract today, we may have more clarity from the Supreme Court. We've decided to put this off until our January, and I'll tell you that if necessary, we will, in fact, look at some changes in this area during the February. I know that Representative Stigler is going to volunteer, I think, as her bill to kind of be the entry point for whatever we may need to do, but at the same time, we want to make certain we allow the judicial branch of government to do their part and decide whether or not the decision that came out of the Court of Appeals is correct or not, make whatever adjustments they may be making, and then we can respond accordingly if we need to regarding that particular decision. So that's off until January, and that will bring us to our next topic, which is the supplemental funds for drug-addicted persons, and I understand Director Williams and Mark, Kadat are going to be our panel for that. I apologize.
Good morning, members of the committee. Max Williams, Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and sitting to my right is Mark Kadat, who is the Chief of the Community Corrections, the Department of Corrections, and works with all of the counties in administering the parole and probation system in the department and throughout the state of Oregon. Mr. Kadat's going to actually provide the bulk of the testimony on sort of where we're at with respect to the distribution of those funds that were identified in the last legislative session for this targeted group of repeat property offenders and how that's rolling out to the counties, and then we'll be available for any questions.
Thank you, Director Williams, chairs, committee members. As Mr. Williams said, my name is Mark Kadat. I'm the Community Corrections Chief for the State of Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm pleased to be here this morning to brief the committee and update you as the department prepares to distribute the $10 million appropriated by the 2009 Legislative Assembly for treatment and interventions for property offenders envisioned by Ballot Measure 57. The companion bill to Measure 57 was House Bill 3638. And that required that the Department of Corrections consult with a variety of stakeholders on how best to distribute those funds. The Community Corrections Commission was chosen to serve this role. The Community Corrections Commission is an advisory group on community corrections issues statewide and has been in existence for many years, and with the addition of several new members, met the criteria for House Bill 3638. I do have a complete list of members of the Community Corrections Commission, should the committee desire that. It's made up of a group of stakeholders, including Sheriff's Association, District Attorneys, Community Corrections, Department of Corrections, Defense Council, Treatment Providers, and AOC, the Association of Oregon Counties, as well. The department, along with the assistance of the Community Corrections Commission, drafted Oregon administrative rules, which govern the distribution of the $10 million funds. Those rules can be found in OAR 291, Division 31. These rules were permanently adopted effective October 23rd of this year. And the rules require that the programs funded be guided by evidence-based practices and designed to reduce both drug addiction and criminal behavior, and that they include a balance of treatment, supervision, sanctions. Acceptable use for the funds include the operation of jails, treatment services, and intensive supervision, including incarceration for violating conditions of supervision for drug-addicted persons charged with or convicted of property crimes who have been placed on community supervision and score as high or medium risk of reoffending. So again, with the guidance of the Community Corrections Commission, the department had prepared an application process for counties to request funding. After obtaining approval of their local public safety coordinating council, the county applications were submitted to the Community Corrections Commission for review. The amount of funds made available to counties was based on a formula that matched the county's percentage share of the Community Corrections grant and aid funds. The commission early on in the process decided that every county should be eligible for a minimum award of $50,000. So after the minimum grant counties were identified, the balance of the remaining funds were made available according to the Community Corrections funding formula. The Community Corrections Commission then reviewed the applications and made funding recommendations to Director Williams. The criteria upon which the commission based their review included, first, the ability of the proposed approach to reduce crime and drug addiction, the extent to which the approach is guided by evidence-based practices and research, whether the proposed approach is comprehensive, involving a mix of supervision, services, and sanctions, and finally, whether the approach is collaborative, engaging all local criminal justice system partners and local service providers working together. Director Williams, after consulting with the commission, reviewed the applications and determined funds to be allocated to each county. Since all funds were not allocated in the first round of funding, the commission decided that the balance would be made available for what we called enhancement funding through a competitive process yet to be defined. Six counties statewide chose not to submit an application for supplemental funding for drug addict persons, leaving an approximate balance of $650,000 for round two enhancement funding. After we received all the program applications and they were approved, we decided to break down the proposals to see how those funds were being used statewide. And we broke them down into three basic categories: supervision, sanctions, and services. And supervision basically is defined as the hiring or retention of parole and probation officers to provide community supervision. Sanctions include jail sanctions as well as alternative sanctions such as work crew, community service, and so forth. And services, which is a broad category, and details direct services, primarily addiction treatment, mental health treatment, housing, and employment services for offenders for this specific population. A review of the proposals indicate that 61% of the funds allocated to counties are to be used for direct services to offenders, while the supervision accounts for 26% and sanctions 13% of the funding. As of this week, the intergovernmental agreements have been sent out to all eligible counties for their legal review. We've started to receive several IGAs back from the counties, and they are awaiting Director Williams' signature, at which point we'll start releasing the funds. Payments are scheduled to be made in two annual allotments. Prior to the second installment, we plan a program review for each county to ensure that the funds are being used for the stated purposes. And then the Criminal Justice Commission will conduct a comprehensive statewide evaluation of all these programs, looking for changes in recidivism, both in terms of reconviction and rearrest, as well as community functioning, which we define as improvements in employment, reductions in drug use, community service, restitution, if there's any of those types of issues. And finally, I'm pleased to report that in the near future, each one of you will be receiving a letter which denotes the amount of funding awarded to you, the counties in your respective districts. So with that, that's kind of an update where we're at with the allocation of those funds, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Questions, starting with Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us those figures again? Supervision accounted for what proportion of the funding? And if we could have a copy of your testimony, that would be even better. But I would like those figures right now.
Chairs, Representative Tomei, the breakdown of the funds, 61% of the funds are to be used for direct offender services. Again, that's primarily treatment, but also includes some employment programs, housing, and mental health services. 26% of the funds account for supervision purposes, and again, that's for either the hiring or retention of parole and probation officers. And then 13% are to be used for sanctioning, and that includes both local incarceration as well as alternative sanction programs.
Follow up, talk a little bit more about the sanction programs, please.
Chairs, Representative Tomei, the sanction programs can include, well, obviously the most serious sanction is local incarceration. The alternative sanctions are a wide variety statewide, and it varies from county to county, but they can include electronic monitoring. So in lieu of incarcerating somebody, they can be put on home detention or house arrest. They can be a work crew program, a supervised work crew program, community service program. And those are the primary alternative sanctions that are used statewide in response to violations short of actual incarceration.
Follow up?
Yes.
It seems to me when we discussed this legislation before, I guess it was not clear to me that my assumption was that all of this money would go for, most of it would go to services, which I'm happy to see that 61% goes to services. But I guess I'm very uncomfortable with the amount that goes into sanctions into jails. It seems to me that was not certainly my understanding of the original intent.
If I could, Chairs and Representative Tomei, certainly that's the language of the bill that allows for all three of those uses. I think, as I recall, as this issue was moving through the legislature, one of the key points was made that while the enhanced treatment for this core group of offenders is absolutely essential, we think, to sort of break the cycle of recidivism and in some cases hopefully divert them from future criminal activity, there also needs to be, with this population that has a high rate of recidivism, given they're typically lower level property offenders, but they have a fairly high rate of recidivism, high risk to reoffend, that you need to both be able to watch this population more intensely, and then you do need some tool to sanction them if they fall out of compliance with whatever conditions they're operating under, either from a probation or a post-prison supervision standpoint. You have to have a swift and sure sanction available. And that's why the language included that. And the part of this that I think I'm perhaps the most enthusiastic about is each one of these plans had to be reviewed by the county's Public Safety Coordinating Council. And we're in a different place, obviously, in every single county with respect to the kinds of services that are available and the kinds of tools that they might be in need of. So in one county that may be struggling right now to have any available jail beds for sanctions, they may need to have a functioning program, the opportunity to open up several jail beds to use as an immediate sanction response, and this money may provide that opportunity for them. Likewise, in another county, they may have sufficient jail beds, but what they don't have is sufficient treatment opportunity, or they might not have enough caseload capability for parole and probation. So it did vary, and we will have, and you should be able to see a breakdown of both generally those numbers that Mr. Cadott went through, but we can also break that down on a county by county basis and show the differences on how each county needed to use it. The six counties that didn't apply were actually small counties, and in those cases I think the counties simply lacked any opportunity, I think, in their minds to sort of leverage the resources and then also to use the process by which the follow-up evaluation was going to be necessary. And I think that's probably the reason they simply opt out of applying for any funds. But in some other counties, for example, Representative, the choice was, because of the limited amount of the money and what they were already doing, what they chose to do was expand slots in their drug court, for example. So they expanded their drug court capability, which would also include some amount of money for supervision and some additional money associated with sanctions. So that's the balance. And I was certainly hopeful, and we would have had a problem, I think, both the commission and myself, approving the plans had the majority of the money not gone into these direct treatment services. But the breakdown as it came through, by and large, I thought was relatively consistent with what we had sort of anticipated, giving the imbalance sometimes of those available services on a county-by-county basis. I hope that's helpful.
Yes, I'm still not completely satisfied, but thank you for your testimony.
So in the written material that you're going to give us, it sounds like what you will be providing for each of us, and I think just give us the statewide, each county, divide out in those three different sections of how much they are receiving for those particular areas. That way we can do a cross-section for we know throughout the state, not just our own districts. And, I can tell you that I've had offline discussions with the director because someone in my one of my counties was concerned how that county decided to apply the funds because it's heavy on the sanction side versus service side. But it did go through some type of, call it check and balance at the community level where each community has their own group and they said, this is what we feel we need. And I think at this point, we've got what we've got and let's see how that actually plays out and we can look at it for the future because we'll have another run at it if we need to. And the last thing, just clarification, those six counties that opted out, the money that would have been going there, my understanding it went back into the other 30 counties, or is that money just sitting somewhere?
Chair Posansky, the money that was dedicated for those six counties will go into the enhancement funding. The counties will have the opportunity to enhance their existing programs. It will be on a more competitive process at some point down the road.
And is that money going to be limited just to the 30 counties that are in the program now, meaning those six, by opting out, they're no longer going to be competing for that money?
Yes, sir. Chair Posansky, that was the decision of the Community Corrections Commission.
That's fine. Senator.
Question. Thank you. And regarding the funding, is this an annual basis? Do they have to reapply every year? Is this a two-year grant? I know the money that you have, I think, is just for this biennium, correct?
Chairs, Senator, yes, it's for this biennium.
We're two payments out.
Correct, two payments.
Okay.
Two installments.
So the follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
So, and you're going to be looking at the rates of recidivism for over what period? Is it going to be the period of the grant? Is, you know, so it's relatively short period. Is it going to be 1 year period?
Chairs, Senator, the Criminal Justice Commission is going to be looking at the outcomes associated with this funding. And there's going to be various outcomes. If we use the definition of recidivism, that's more of a long-term look at this population. We're also going to be looking at more short-term, like I mentioned, the employment, you know, how soon are they employed, how many were employed, the reduction in drug use, and other short-term outcomes, as well as the more long-term recidivism rates.
Mr. Chair, for chairs, I was going to say it would be, I think, really helpful to have either these gentlemen or the commission come back in a year and report those findings, because obviously as we're looking at whether to renew the program, it's sort of hard just within a short time of a year. I know, I realize that's why I asked about what the time frame was for the rate of recidivism.
In chairs and Senator Posansky, we certainly, in conjunction with the Criminal Justice Commission, as the data is getting collected and processing, I think there'll be regular updates as to what we can say. I want to be real careful of not over-promising what we'll be able to say about the effect of this funding with respect to an actual impact on recidivism within a year. It's just too short to probably draw any sort of statistically significant conclusions about it, but the data collection issues are there, and to the extent that this money is going out separately from the normal grant
in aid to for community corrections. This probably has the largest number of sort of new standards associated with how the data has to be collected, what information is being captured, to allow exactly that kind of more detailed follow-up by the Community Corrections Commission, which was specifically the intent of the legislature, I believe, at least in the language that we were given to operate under in the statute. So we'll be collecting all that data and providing feedback as soon as we have something valuable to share.
Thank you.
Senator Wissett, did you have comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Pursuant to the intergovernment agreement, it says no modification to an approved plan shall be placed into effect without prior written notification of the director or designee. Does that connote that the director will be making the decision whether the alterations in the agreement will be tolerated, or does it simply mean that the local area can make the modification and just let you know what they're doing?
Chairs and Senator Whitsitt, it would be my sense that the statute gives me the obligation to sort of oversee the money in a manner that would be implemented consistent with the statute. And so if there's a determination made after sort of review by my staff and also the Community Corrections Commission, who's acting as our advisory panel essentially on this money, that someone's using the funds either outside of the designated areas that have previously been approved or in an amount that's beyond that, I think we're going to have to either approve it, or if we disapprove it, there's a process, I think, under the administrative rules by which we could suspend the second payment. It's one of the reasons in between the first payment and the second payment, we'll go out and do an evaluation and make sure that the money's being spent where it's been committed to for that very purpose. So I think would be within our right to argue for a suspension of any additional funding if we thought the money wasn't being used appropriately. That is not to say, however, that they may have, like so many of us that are dealing with sort of uncertain budgets and times when things are changing, there may be a circumstance in a particular county where they need to make a change. Perhaps maybe more jail money's been approved in some sort of a measure, and they want to redirect some of those issues to buy additional alcohol and drug treatment, for example. I would certainly entertain that and work with the local entity to try to make sure it was consistent with the statute. And if we felt it wasn't, then would escalate that conversation appropriately.
If I may follow up, just then, if I understood your answer, as long as the modifications are consistent with the statute, you would probably sanction the changes as opposed to dictating what the changes would be to the local people.
Chairs and Senator Whitsitt, we always provide, I think, an appropriate level of deference to the Public Safety Coordinating Council. So if it was within the statutory framework and didn't do harm to the purpose of the funds, I think we'd likely approve it if that's what the local folks wanted to do. But it would be a conversation. And again, the balance for me is the over-reliance on buying additional jail beds and not spending the money to target sort of the treatment side of this issue would be a place where I'd start to have concern. And I think that's a county-by-county situation based on what they've got and what they can put on the table at the time.
Thank you, Max.
Is this actually going to get all the senators?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And I just want to ask if you are able to get data on the other six counties as well as the counties who have applied, so that when you say you go out in between before the second distribution of funds, I'd want to keep an eye on the six counties to find out if in fact why they didn't apply was truly because they didn't have the facilities or the ability to implement any programs. I'm a little bit concerned that there's going to be a disproportionate amount of treatment need in those six counties.
Chairs and Senator, the intention is that we are going to follow up with those six counties and see what the issues and problems were with their decision for not seeking funding under this agreement. So that's an issue we want to follow up on and find out what the reasons are behind that decision.
And for the record, Chairs and Senator Bonamici, and I might not be able to do it off the top of my head, so Mr. Kadak can keep me honest here if we can do it, but so we're not sort of talking about the mystery six counties, you might want to know actually which six were that didn't apply. My understanding is it was Coos, Curry, I want to say Malheur, Coos, Curry, Gillum, Sherman, Wasco, and Wheeler. I'm wrong. Malheur did. So it was Coos, Curry, Gillum, Sherman, Wasco, and Wheeler County. So those are the counties. Most of you, I'm sure, are better aware than I am of the financial challenges that a number of those small counties, many of them impacted particularly by the federal payments timber issues, and I suspect there may have just been a sense internally that they lacked the collective resources as a community to come together, put a plan together, and then meet the requirements of trying to execute that plan over the next 2 years. That's going to be my guess is what their response is going to be, although we'll certainly pursue that with them.
Thank you.
Anything on the House side? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our last panel that's scheduled for today is on the update on House Bill 2489, and Director Williams is going to be part of that, and Tom Kellen from DMV.
Thank you, Chairs. For the record, my name is Max Williams. Again, I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and seated with me is Tom McClellan, who is, Tom, I don't even remember your title.
DMV Administrator.
The Administrator for the Department of Motor Vehicles, and we're here to report on a piece of legislation that was passed in the last session relating to the combined efforts of the Department of Corrections and DMV to try to get ID cards, state ID cards, issued to offenders prior to them releasing back to the community, which is a significant part of our efforts at reentry and transition. This has been an item that has been identified by the Oregon Reentry Council by the Governor's Reentry Council as an important issue, and obviously reinforced by legislation that was sponsored actually by Representative Cameron on this committee. And we appreciate, frankly, the committee's interest in this ongoing and important issue of offender reentry. As you know, we release about 4,500 offenders annually back into the community, and they're having a valid Oregon ID is sort of initial foundational building block to their successful issues about applying for employment and housing and all the other things that are incumbent upon someone releasing from prison. Likewise, there are even tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, frankly, also that release regularly from Oregon jails and in some cases face some of these same sort of challenges. But particularly our effort was to focus on that longer-term population who goes to prison, usually loses their driving privilege through expiration or court limitation, and then at the end of their time in prison is coming back out trying to start over again and the components associated with those challenges. So I've got several points I'd like to make, but I obviously want to give Mr. McClellan the opportunity to make any introductory remarks as well.
Mr. Brzezinski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Again, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator. I think you have some written testimony from me. I'd like to just quickly go through that, set the stage a little bit from a DMV perspective and the things that we have been doing and plan to do with corrections. I know Director Williams would also like to add some points as well. So first off, we've covered what the bill entails. It's really assistance to offenders while they're still incarcerated with obtaining a driver's license or an ID card. But the bill doesn't really just describe what that assistance entails. And so I wanted to talk to you about some of the assistance we provide today and some things we've tried in a pilot and some future things that we would like to explore a little bit further. First point, though, is over the last 3 years, as you're probably aware, driver licensing issuance has become much more difficult for people to obtain a driver license and an ID card. The requirements are much more stringent to prove eligibility. The systems that we use to verify the data that people provide to us is now in place that wasn't there before. We're doing facial recognition of pictures when people come in compared to their previous photos on file and the entire database to see if there's any fraud or ID theft being performed. You have to prove you're in the country legally to get a driver's license. You have to have an address. All these factors that many of your constituents probably have contacted you about, have made it difficult for everyone to obtain a driver's license or an ID card, but I think especially for this population, who frequently do not have a birth certificate or a Social Security card, probably don't have an address identified for where they're going to be when they are released. It's very difficult for them. So taking all that in mind and not wanting to take any steps backward in our process that we've, our hard-fought wins, I think, in making it a more secure process, and now a credential that is has more is respected more across the country as good, solid photo ID. We don't want to take any steps back in this process. We don't want any special favoritism or special steps taken for this group. But we recognize there are barriers, and maybe there's some things we can do to lower those barriers and provide additional assistance to them, but not lower the standards in any way. That's kind of the goal that I have, this process. Currently, and on the second page of my testimony, I've listed some of the things that we are doing today to assist offenders and their counselors and other DOC staff that work with them. We provide information to staff just on the basics of how do you obtain a driver's license or an ID card in Oregon? What documents do you need to have? What's it cost? You know, those types of things. And the department's been very active in establishing a reentry wiki, like a Wikipedia type of thing that helps provide information in local communities about what is available to assist offenders with reentering communities successfully. We've added some driver licensing type information, and how do you reinstate a driving privilege that's been suspended? What are the steps you need to go through for that process? So that's additional information, content that can be very helpful to them. We also participate in transition fairs that are held within the institutions. We'll have our staff there to assist inmates, offenders, with the questions that they might have about how do you obtain a driver's license or especially reinstating driving privileges. While they are incarcerated, many of them will write to us and ask what the steps are for them specifically to reinstate their driving privileges. They'll provide their name, a date of birth, and a driver's license number, and we'll do that lookup for them and mail back. We have a checklist that we fill out. It says, here's what you have to do, and here's, you know, five dockets that you need to take care of in Clackamas County and Douglas County and wherever they might be. So they know specifically what steps they have to take in order to get their driving privileges back. Do they need to file an SR-22 for insurance purposes? Do they need to pay for to reinstate their license? There's a lot of different things, and it's case specific, and we do that through the mail and both, and also over the telephone. For many of them, it's just a matter of clearing up all those suspensions in order to get a new driver's license. So that is a service we provide. As part of Senate Bill 1080, which is the legal presence bill from February 2008, we have added, we're calling it ombudsman services, special assistance to people who have special needs in getting through the process. Corrections and their staff have done an excellent job of helping offenders obtain copies of their birth certificates and replacement Social Security cards prior to leaving the institutions. They've done just a great job. It's very difficult because some of them don't know where they were born or who they were born to. And each state and the counties within states have different requirements, processes, and fees. It's a very complicated process. They've developed some extra expertise, and we certainly have as well. We're there to assist them if they have any additional help that they need to be able to leave the institution with those identity documents that are really... they open doors for people, just like the driver license does. So we're there to help with those. We meet regularly with members of MAX's staff to talk about these issues, to update on changes that may have happened in our procedures and our requirements. One of the things that we've identified that probably would be very helpful is to develop a better screening tool to determine what the individual specifically needs in order to leave the institution with photo ID. And that may not be a driver's license. It may be an ID card that we've issued. And the person may need to surrender their driving privileges in order to obtain an ID card from us. You can't have both in the state of Oregon. You can't have driving privileges and an ID card. Statute prohibits that. And so that probably does create a barrier for people who have multiple suspensions, maybe several years before they're eligible to get a new new driver's license issued to them. Maybe the best step for them is just to surrender those driving privileges and apply for an ID card if that's the goal. That may not be the goal of the offender. The offender wants to drive the day they're released. But if the goal is really to have photo identification, maybe the ID card is the best route, and then later take care of those driving issues that they have on their record. We haven't spent enough time really digging in person by person to see how many people are in that situation versus those that just have lost their card and need to have one issued to them. So those are some of the things we're looking at. We have just recently signed an interagency agreement. The two agencies will be working together. That is a provision that's in the bill. We have that in place. Probably the primary item that's in that is to convene a joint project team of DMV and corrections staff to work between December 1st and the end of June, looking at least two different models, probably more, of ways that cards could be issued to inmates from the institutions. One of the examples being looked at is a mobile unit. There are a few states, not very many, but there are a few that have like large RVs or vans that they've equipped with DMV issuance systems that they drive to different locations. We're gathering information about what those states have done. So far, we haven't found any that have those and the facial recognition requirement. So it's a special technology and equipment. But I'm sure we can work through those types of impediments if we just get the information together. So get the project teams together, the experts from my staff and from NACSA's staff can get together and evaluate these options. I think we can come with some proposals possibly for the next legislative session in 2011 to let you know what would it cost. Are there staffing implications? Are there physical changes we need to make at any of the institutions around the security of networks, not security so much as physical security, but networks and things like that, connectivity? There's a lot of issues for us as far as if we go into the institution to actually be able to produce the cards. You may not know that about 3 years ago, we moved to a central issuance process. You no longer come to a DMV and leave with a laminated card. You leave with we call it an interim card, but it's a piece of paper really as a receipt with your name and the information on it. And the secure card is mailed to you 5 to 7 days later. That creates, it gives us the opportunity to do the facial recognition comparison in a batch mode overnight for the fraud detection purposes. But it also means we need a valid address to mail that card to an offender. And it should be an address that they're likely to be at for several months after they are released in case we need to contact them for any reason, like additional suspensions that might occur or things like that. So we worked through some of those issues for a pilot that we did here in Salem for 6 months, limited scope from March through August, that we are going to reinstate. I believe it was successful. But it was very small. It was 36 offenders went through that program in 6 months where they we did some preliminary assessment of their eligibility, and they were transported from Oregon State Penitentiary Minimum Security Unit to one of our local offices here in Salem prior to being open to the public. So like at 7 o'clock in the morning, they would come in with a van, and 4 to 10 inmates would come in at a time. In this case, they had pristine documents because they had just been issued certified copies of the birth certificates and Social Security cards. They were very well prepared, and the Department of Corrections paid for the ID cards, and those went through very quickly. All 36 of them received ID cards. It may be a model that we can expand on. I don't believe it fits for every inmate, and it's an expensive option as far as the transport and time. But we were able to change the schedules of our staff, just adjusting their work schedules to avoid overtime that otherwise would have been incurred. That's one of the things that we would like to reinstate and maybe expand upon within the state. So there's a lot of things that we're doing. I'm I'm encouraged by the study that we're going to do, because I think I've heard from a few of the members, they're very interested in can we get them cards while they're in the prison, and can you send a mobile unit, or can you set up a mini DMV office within one or more institutions. We haven't really evaluated those to the depth that we need to, and explored the issues that I believe we need to before we can invest in that kind of a solution. So those are some of the comments that I wanted to make.
Co-chairs and committee, I'll just, Mr. McClellan did a good job, I think, of outlining our joint efforts. Key for me is the fact that we've now got this intergovernmental agreement that will drive us to sort of a final analysis of all of these options by June of next year, where we should be able to identify what's workable, the cost-benefit implications of those from both a DMV and a DOC perspective. And, it remains our hopeful position that we find a way where we can actually have those cards issued prior to someone actually walking out of the facility. Even with the documents that we spend considerable effort trying to come up with, working with, we had a breakthrough with the Social Security Administration in the last couple of years to get the reissuance of Social Security cards process working. We have a substantial number of our inmate population who weren't born in Oregon. So tracking down their birth certificate from another state in order to be able to prove identity to meet the standards that DMV is obligated to meet under the Real ID Act to reflect those documents. It's been an aggressive effort on our part. And so we have made progress because a vast number of those people now are having in their packet, as they walk out the door, access to those documents that can prove who they are for purposes of that ID. But they still have a distance to go in actually getting that physical ID card. And with the investment of those documents, we're not always that excited about having people walk out the door with them and then not end up going to the DMV and not getting that card. And as Tom was talking, I recollected while I was in college taking a German cultural history class, I read a book once called The Hauptmann von Köpernick, which is sort of a German book. But in the story, it was about it sounds a little German, doesn't it? In the story, it talks about someone who released from prison and needed a certain form signed, but to get the form signed, he needed another signed document that he couldn't get without the form signed on releasing from prison. And that's a bit of the challenge we have with these offenders when they're releasing out. They need an ID card, but to get an ID card, they've got to get a birth certificate. And to get the birth certificate, they've also got to show that they've got that Social Security number. And so it's all of these additional barriers that get stacked up on a group of people, frankly, that are challenged. I don't know about the rest of you, but I have trepidation when I walk into a DMV office to get my own driver's license renewal. Imagine people who have been out of the system for a period of time, and they're struggling to meet all of the other things that they've got on their list of conditions that have been imposed upon them as part of the process of their supervision upon release. And that's what we're trying to break through here. And in a perfect world, we'll find a way to do this prior to their release. They'll be able to have that ID card when they walk out the door. And if it means surrendering their driving privileges because of outstanding warrants and other issues associated with their driving record, then that's the thing that we're going to be recommending that they do. And we're going to figure out a way to make that fairly streamlined for them. But that's our objective, and that's the goal that we have. We believe that the current status of the agreement that we've entered into with DMV, we understand the technical issues that they have. They have a computer system that may not take, for example, a digital image that we would take a picture of and try to transmit to them over our computer network. It may not fit into the way their computer system operates for purposes of doing that facial recognition work. We're going to explore whether or not there's a way to make that happen, and it may not be cost effective, so we may have to look at another model, like setting up a mini DMV office inside our intake institution, for example, to get that work done. But we'll come back with a set of options and what those cost-benefit pieces are. But please understand that we are committed, both of us, DOC and DMV, to continuing to get better at what we are doing with how we're trying to break those barriers down to get inmates ID upon release, from our aggressive efforts at the documentation to their aggressive efforts at trying to inform inmates of the processes they're going to need to go through when it comes time to release, until the time we can actually issue that card prior to their release from prison. So that's generally the information, and we appreciate the committee's interest in the issue, and we hope you'll continue to support us as we move down this path to more effectively transition offenders back to the community with the purpose of reducing crime and violence and victimization and improving public safety in our communities. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs. Thank you for your work in this area, and can appreciate it. I actually have a friend whose bag was stolen when she was doing some work in South Africa, and she said it was much easier to replace her U.S. passport than her Oregon driver's license, but that's not my question. I hope that some of the work that you are doing can also translate into some of the challenges that others may be having, for example, homeless who are trying to transition into the workforce or victims of domestic violence and people who are identified as perhaps having the same challenges. And I wanted to ask you about the address issue. I would assume that some people, when they're released, know where they're going, and others have to kind of figure that out. So what's the solution there? Do they use a temporary address, and then you put that on their driver's license, and then they have to change it later? And if so, they don't have anything saying that that's where they live now, so is that one of those catch-22 situations?
Chairs and Senator Bonamici, that is in fact the problem. I always make my staff nervous when I pull the statistic off the top of my head. But my recollection is about half of our population releases out where we have an address identified for them, and sometimes that's a family member. Sometimes it's the local mission, which we know is going to be a temporary address upon release. So in those cases, our recommendation has been that we use the local parole and probation office. Everybody who is releasing within 24 hours typically is going to be checking in at the parole and probation office, and at least for a period of time, that's going to be a known permanent address where they, and it's a good address, frankly, for DMV, because if there is something that pops up that still needs to get taken care of after the issuance of whatever that credential is, these people are going to be under some level of supervision, at least for the initial part of their release, and that's a good way to get in touch with them. So that's but it is a problem, and it is exactly back to that sort of chicken and egg or catch 22. You need an address, but you need an ID card to get an address to get an address. And we've typically found that your Oregon State Department of Corrections ID card is not the opening piece of ID that you necessarily want to show a prospective employer or a prospective landlord. So that's part of what we're trying to overcome here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank both of you for coming forward today probably owe you an apology for my reaction at a meeting that you had the other day. This document's a great document, and hopefully we'll move forward. Tom, this question is probably more directed for you on scheduling, and I just heard you talk about you could change people's schedules to serve inmates that are coming in early in the morning. You have that degree of flexibility in scheduling your people.
Co-chairs, Representative Cameron, we did that with we had some managers actually who don't get paid overtime. But then we can also sometimes adjust a schedule. The trade-off is maybe longer lines for the general public if we're shorter staffed at different times of the day. So in this limited case for one day a month, we were able to say, okay, this week you're going to come in at 6:30 or 7 and you're going to serve this group, but you're going to get off early, later in the day. Or if it was a manager, just accept it, you're going to work a longer day. But it was... that's how we're able to get through with the pilot.
Follow up, if I may. Recently, the DMVs here in Salem, both of them were closed on the same day. Can you tell me why we couldn't keep one open and close one Friday and then close the next one the next Friday so that the general public could be served using the same exact hours on the schedule?
Co-chairs, Representative Cameron, I believe you're referencing the mandatory unpaid furlough days.
Yes. Whatever caused both DMVs to be closed on the same day. Can you tell me about that scheduling?
Yeah, that was, Representative Cameron, that was statewide. Several state agencies were subject to that for cost-saving measures. All DMV offices were closed. And again, we'll be closed the day after Thanksgiving this month. Let's get my plug in, let you know. Because of the reductions in our budgets and the collective bargaining agreements that were approved, there are a minimum of 10 unpaid closure days, furlough days, that our employees are subject to, and potentially an extra 2 to 4 days that we will flex, as you're describing, we will flex throughout the biennium. with those employees. But I guess that's the reason.
Okay. Well, I'm curious. Could you, if something above you obviously stops you from doing this, is there what's the reason we in Salem couldn't have one DMV closed on one Friday and another DMV closed on another Friday so that the general public would be able to be served every Friday? I'm trying to figure out who made that decision?
Yeah, Representative, I think what happened is in the negotiations with the labor unions and the executive branches, they went across the board and said these days, which are 10 days, statewide, all of these are going to be closed as compared to flexing certain offices. I think from what I'm understanding, because I've had the same discussion, was it was above them and it's something that we didn't legislate. It just occurred through this work reduction to save money, and if you actually split and flexed it, you may not get the same savings because you're still having the impact of having an office open, where if it shut down completely, supposedly you're saving more money, being more efficient.
Just to clarify, Tom, can you tell me where that decision was made? What office, what level?
We can bring Joe O'Leary up in the governor's office.
Can you?
Mr. Co-Chairs?
I love volunteers.
We're married, but we bring her up.
Yeah, well, you know, she stepped out.
Welcome. Welcome, Mr. O'Leary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski and effective December 1st General Counsel, noting for the record it's still November 19th. I think, Representative Cameron, I think that question you pose is a good one. I think that the appropriate folks to answer that would be Scott Hara, the Director of the Department of Administrative Services, because as Senator Przanski pointed out, this was both an issue around collective bargaining, which is done at DAS, Department of Administrative Services, and the budget reductions that were assumed as part of the end of session bill that assumed certain furlough savings. I wish I had the answer, but I don't.
Thank you. It's always nice to have people in the audience that you can call up.
Now I know, unfortunately.
So they can suggest somebody else.
Now I know that Joe will be up in the office watching the TV.
And he's practicing to be general counsel. If he wants to answer.
Mr. Chair, just leave on a positive note. Thank you for this document. And I know that this has been an issue for a long time, and I appreciate the test that was made. I appreciate the other solutions that you've put down here that you're going to explore, and I know that this committee is all supportive of that. And I heard earlier today testimony, you guys sat through the whole testimony today about vets, and there's all kinds of special needs that we have to be flexible for and try to do that, and I appreciate your willingness to move forward. I know you have a tough job to do, and the documents that are coming out of DOC that you've been working on for the last year, 2,000 people got their Social Security and birth certificates at DOC this year. That's huge, and that's going to make a big difference when they come out and when we go to get these ID cards for them. Thank you.
So, Tom, one thing I just want to get clarity and put on the record. When we talk about giving up driving privileges and also people that have suspensions, it's my understanding if you are suspended by a court for failure to pay, you basically have to take care of the obligation of the court. Then you go to the DMV and you pay a reinstatement fee and you get your license. And I'm assuming what you're saying, if someone has to give up their driving privileges to get an ID card, which is required by statute, does that mean that they have to start, quote unquote, all over when they want to get their driver's license? They have to go out and take the test and get re-evaluated, and that's the dilemma?
Chair Przanski, that pretty much is the case. Those suspensions will stay on their record. They'll still have to take care of them and pay to either reinstate if it's been within a year of surrendering the license, or go through and apply for an original license again and do all the tests, the knowledge tests, the behind-the-wheel tests, those types of tests. It'll depend on how long they were without the driver's license. But if the goal is photo ID, that may be the fastest and actually the least expensive approach for them to take.
Right.
Just to follow up on that, but that's no different than ordinary Joe Citizen who might have gotten their license suspended for a myriad of things, and they're stuck in the same dilemma. So yes, there's no different disadvantage. I mean, it's mm-hmm. the same across.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And for staff, what else do we need to cover, if anything?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's it for the until January.
House committee's adjourned.
And the Senate committee's adjourned. And thank you, everyone, for being here today.
Have a good